Samir, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Sorry, I was on mute.
Okay. We start in about 30 seconds. I have a lot of questions about the new BRICS institution, and is it really competition with the IMF and what they're doing, or is it, you know, they want to be at the same mahogany table eventually and all this other stuff. I've been doing some research, and I appreciate you coming on. But I want to let you tell everything about your organization, and I'm going to introduce you and let you express yourself, and then we'll get into it. We got the hour, okay?
Sounds good.
All right, here we go.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear, no fear, no fear, no fear, no fear here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the BEA Utiful Studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. Okay, today, let me tell you what's going to happen. We have a lot of good stuff going on. Saturday, I had some time Saturday morning, and I sat down, I said, you know what? I've been asking questions over this whole last week about the Bitcoin licensing thing, and then we got, you know, international finance and the BRICS up there saying we're going to compete, we're going to have our own competition with, you know, like the IMF and World Bank and the Bank of International Settlements, and we're just going to do it ourselves. We got Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and we're just had it with the domination by the Western culture, U.S., we rule you, you got to comply or die kind of crap, okay? We're just doing it ourselves. But then, as you do some research, you start to find out that, well, we could all get along and be on the, you know, sit at the same table, and we'd just have a really big eye at the top of the pyramid. So I'm going, okay, so we're working on that. In the second hour, we have David Johnson on again from Bit Angels, because when we talked to him, it was right before they announced licensing for Bitcoin. Bit licenses that'll morph into internet licenses. And I got some pointed questions for Mr. David Johnson, because with the Bitcoin Foundation and so on, they were kind of working with the man, and they had that work out. Then in the third hour, we have Terry Bressy from Checkpoint USA. He just had another case, you know, with the Border Patrol down there. They, you know, he didn't like him saying, am I being detained? So they detained him, and he goes, you know what? Let's go to court again, and he won again, and we're gonna find out. You know, they need to, you know, get all the boys a memo and say leave Terry alone. But in the first hour, from India, right now live from India by Skype, we have Samir Dosani. Now Samir is going to talk to us about the BRICS. Okay, now Samir Dosani has been working on issues of debt, development, human rights, and the international financial institutions for over 10 years, including as executive director, 50 years, is enough. Okay, now, is enough is the actionaid.org is an organization that he's representing. Tell us all about it. U.S. Network of Global Economic Justice. Now, we're going to be dealing with, it's how the developing countries are treated. You know, it's going to go, you know, how did all of our oil get underneath your sand? I mean, you know, how did your resources get in inside your jungle? You know, we're going to, and it's with debt. That's how that stuff happens. He's been working on international economic justice issues for over 10 years, including leading the International Network on Accountability of the Asian Development Bank and the U.S. Network for Economic Justice. Let's say hello to Sameer Dosani. Sameer, I got you there?
Yes, indeed, sir.
Okay. Now, this is, help me out here. I wanted to go ahead and give you an opportunity to introduce us to ActionAid.org. Tell us all about your organization.
Sure. We're a network of organizations working in 45 countries around the world to end poverty. And where our methodology is to use what we call the human rights-based approach. So instead of, you know, giving people services per se, we're going to help work with communities to help them to agitate for their rights and to get the rights from the governments that they live with.
Okay, now define that, though. You know, the rights that they deserve. Do they deserve some of my tax money or something? I mean, what is it you're asking for and from whom?
Yeah, I mean, in 1948, the world had a choice. We could continue to, you know, live basically by rule of the gun, which is how we've lived for millennia. But we knew after the detonation of nuclear weapons, we knew that the next time we sort of did this, we were going to all die, right? So what we decided was we're going to have an international legal framework. We're going to have an international human rights framework, which says great things like everyone has the right to a job. Everyone has the right to good food and good nutrition. Everyone has the right to clean water. And everyone also has the right not to be locked up arbitrarily by their government. And everyone also has the right to free speech, free religion, and so on. So these are the human rights that we all, you know, it's just a matter of international law now that every single human being theoretically has this. The implementation is always the hard part. So we're one of the groups that's focusing more on the economic side. There are groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch that focus more on the civil and political side. So we're more talking about, you know, the right to food, the right to eat, the right to have a job. These are the kind of things that we talk to. And we focus a lot on education and on women's rights.
Okay, now let's go ahead. I want to make sure that we're clear on this, because when you say a right to a job, does that mean, I mean, in case you didn't know, I'm going to make sure you get to express yourself, because I really needed someone like you to be able to help us understand this international finance thing. But we're libertarians, you know, we're kind of like, you know, when you say a right to a job or a right to food or a right, I'm just wondering, do I have a right to not have to take it from my family to do it? So when you say, is it economically you want to try and build an infrastructure or an economic system that supports them, and all they've been doing is just exploiting everybody everywhere? Or are you looking like, you know, I have too much, so I need to give it? I mean, define that for me. Help me understand what you're asking for.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're asking is a very deep question, which is, you know, what are the communities, the kind of communities that we want to live in? If we say we're a libertarian, if we say we're socialist, whatever we say, what do those communities look like? And I think the answer is we want communities that, you know, that where people are coming together and helping each other out, where things look differently than what they look now, which is exploitation by the 0.1% of everyone else, of the 99.9%. So that's sort of our utopia. So we can articulate our utopian vision, and you and I may agree about a lot of that. But we also live in a world with nation states. And nation states, you know, just function based on sort of control and responsibility. And they have the responsibility, nation states have the responsibility, not to make sure that every individual has a job, but to make sure that they have a system whereby every individual can have a job if he or she wants, and that they're investing not they're not taking money and giving it to the 1%, but rather that they're investing in roads and bridges and schools and hospitals that will create jobs for all. So this is the kind of changes that we want to see.
Thank you. I this is what I'm looking at, what I have seen, you know, in any kind of attention I give these issues at all, is that the financing to developing countries is always at the expense of the people there. It's like, you look like you need a bridge, a road, a harbor, an airport, you know, or the highway system, whatever. And then we benefit by having our companies come and build it. And then you owe us for the rest of your life, and you need to raise some taxes. So I'm going, it's not working. I'm wondering, define...
Yeah, it's slightly worse. It's slightly worse than the picture that you're describing.
Well, please, go ahead and describe what's going on and how the BRICS would make it better. And then certainly in some of the coming segments, we're almost through this first segment, is that I'm seeing that, you know, the BRICS really, in the back rooms, as I'm doing research, they just want to be at the same table. They want to be part of, they want to be included. They want to have a voice instead of being competition. They want to be added. And I'm like, whoa, like that's not going to be better.
Yeah. I mean, I think let's describe the status quo. So the status quo is not only the sort of corporate welfare.
Okay, let's go ahead and start there. We're going to go hit the break of music here in about 2 seconds, and I don't want to interrupt you. So when we come back, the status quo, describing the status quo, Sameer Dosani from India. And, well, I don't know where he's from, but he's in India now. So South Africa, where they have their headquarters, ActionAid.org. Go pull it up. You know, we're going to be talking a lot about ActionAid and the international banking system. Sameer Dosani, when we come back. You guys stay right there. Did you agree? Did you totally agree? I'll bet that you did. But did you read the agreement? There are 7 billion people on Earth, and there are over 6 billion active cell phone accounts right now. And every one of them came with an agreement. Billions have already agreed to allow entities that they do not know to use and abuse every feature of their mobile devices. Your computer activity is monitored and archived. Your car is tracked, and even your face is scanned. The current power structure grows more fearful every day of your desire for anonymity, independence, free association, freedom of movement, freedom of expression, and your freedom of thought. And entire categories of humans will be targeted. And if they, then those that won't leave us alone, determine that we are not within their control, then we will be categorized as out of control. FreedomsPhoenix.com will launch the next phase of the Levolution by the end of the summer of 2014. And if you have to tell your neighbors about it, then we did it wrong. Okay, what that commercial is about, I don't know, did you do any research on who we are or anything?
Nope, sorry, didn't have time.
Yeah, no, that's fine, that's fine. I'll give you the short version. Are you familiar with the Ron Paul effort in 08 and 12?
Sure.
The Ron Paul Revolution, the Levolution, that logo, I'm the one that created that. Now, what happened here out of Phoenix, we understood what was going to happen socially because we're libertarian activists. I've been around since the late 80s. Well, every year we put on an event called the Freedom Summit, and Ron Paul has spoken at 3 of them. And what happened was we understood what was going to happen when you had a libertarian get up there and say, you know what, we can just come home. We don't need to have these wars. No, by the way, you know, let's just ignore the Federal Reserve and the banking thing. So when you get tens of thousands at a time, wherever with 24-hour notice, you'll have 5,000 to 10,000 teenagers and young 20-something-year-olds showing up screaming in the Fed. The banks went, "What the hell was that?" You know, they just what? So the thing is that I understand this issue, you know, very well, but as it applies to other countries and certainly the developing world, the banking system here is to benefit by exploiting in the name of whoever their buddies are, and kind of I get it, okay? But as we come across with this in the next hour, we talk a lot about them trying to regulate and get licensing for cryptocurrencies, and I'm going, wow, they see Bitcoin as just another regional currency, and they want to include it under regulation so that it's not competition. As I was doing research over the weekend, I find out that BRICS is kind of the same thing. The BRICS is just another, you know, monetary system outside of their control, and they're going, oh, hell no. Well, I got the impression in a lot of the stories from April 2010, the BRICS made it clear that they wanted to be on par with and work with and be at the table of. And then just in the beginning of July, you know, this month still, there was a another article that described the same thing. And I'm going, I'm not sure this is going to be what you wanted. I don't know how much you know about that, but that's what I'm building up to my question. But the first thing is, you helping us with the status quo is going to help a lot, okay?
I'm with you.
So we'll go with that. You kind of feel me, what I'm looking at?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right, good. Thank you, Sameer. And that's where we'll go. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the best liberty-oriented audio streamed around the clock, on the air and online. This is the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM.
Rhodes, it's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't.
any roads.
Because we don't need them! You know, where's my jets and car? You know, government's got in my way. You know what? You know the reason that we're going to have roads? It's because they indebted my grandchildren 30 years to pay for them. That's why. Because they go, you look like you need some roads. Well, I'd just rather have a jets and air car. No. No, we can't. We can't. We can't. Tax for, like, flying and stuff. Well, they will. They'll try. Okay, Samir Dosani from ActionAid.org, representing developing countries' human rights to, like, you know, hey, man, can I feed myself? So this ability to grant financing, you know, go put them in debt, which is not necessarily, you know, good idea in my opinion, but... You know, to try and make it more fair, even kind of just seriously, you're just going to exploit. You know, we have loan China. They'll go into Africa. They'll say, yeah, I get 10 years of no tax. What? Not a problem. We put a manufacturing plant there. You owe your 16 hours a day and you owe your soul to the company store. And we sell her the import and everything. And then the tax breaks are over at 10 years and we move it over here. Okay, so this is always, there's always a bottom line. There's always, it's not, you know, social justice in the name of somebody doing business, because there's a bottom line and, you know, quarterly reports and shareholders and stuff, you know. But wasn't that what all this aid and financing and everything was supposed to help people be able to help themselves? They don't want a middle class out there telling they, them, those what to do. They just want to, they just want to use you as slaves. Well, that might be what they think of the status quo. Samir, help me out. Status quo. What are we looking at?
Yeah, I mean, to understand the status quo, we got to go back 100 years ago when most of the developing countries were still in a colonial system.
Please.
Now, what was the colonial system about? It was about taking out resources. It was about taking out diamonds. It was about taking out oil, about taking out cotton, and then turning that. So that was a raw material. You take that out from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America, and you put it into Europe, and then you produce finished goods. So let's take a concrete example. In India, where I'm speaking to you from, not 50 miles from where I am, there were massive cotton farms producing lots and lots of cotton. This was going to the mill workers in Liverpool, in northern parts of England, who were producing garments. The garments were shipped back here because there weren't a lot of people in England. There still aren't a lot of people in England. The garments were shipped back here to India to be sold here. So we were exporting low-value stuff and we were importing high-value stuff. And it killed our economy, the Indian economy, okay? Now, in the post-colonial period, we have more or less the same thing. We have investment in infrastructure, but infrastructure for whom? It's not for me to be able to go to my school. It's for resources to be able to come out of, say, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So those diamonds, that has a lot of diamonds, that has a lot of many other kind of minerals. Those minerals to come out of DRC and to be turned into, you know, either rings or, you know, smartphones or whatever it may be. And then those things are sold back to developing countries. So this is really a hugely unfair economic system that we're into. And it's this system that the World Bank and the IMF and sort of Europe in general and the North America in general, the U.S. especially, has a huge vested interest in maintaining. So when we're talking about the BRICS, when we're talking about alternatives, we have to understand the fundamental question is, are any of these alternatives going to change this colonial and post-colonial economic pattern or not?
I don't know. Is it? I mean, is that even their plan?
Yeah, no, explicitly they're not talking like this at all. And certainly, you know, when we see the fact that they're going to transact, they're going to conduct their business in U.S. dollars, we get very nervous. Because part of this is, you know, the U.S. dollar is propped up through all kinds of mechanisms. But one mechanism to prop it up is that a lot of the international trade that happens in U.S. dollars. So really it was a step backwards when the governments announced 2 weeks ago in their meeting in Fortaleza that both the Contingency Reserve Agreement, which is the alternative to the IMF, and the New Development Bank, so-called BRICS Bank, which is the alternative to the World Bank, both of these are going to conduct business in U.S. dollars. So this was a bit of a blow.
Was that expected? I mean, I thought that was the whole point, was to not do the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, from where I sit, it's even worse than that, because the Contingency Reserve Agreement, which is, again, an alternative to the IMF. So remember, the problem with the IMF is that it locks countries into these harmful economic conditions, privatization, liberalization, and budget cuts, budget austerity, which I'm not saying countries couldn't follow those if they wanted to, but they shouldn't have to follow those. And that was very much what the IMF had as its recipe.
Okay, wait a minute. What, say that again?
Privatization, which means the government has to sell off all of its assets. Liberalization, which means you know, you can't stop the flow of cheap goods coming from the U.S. or from China or wherever the cheapest goods are coming from. If you want to say, okay, wait a sec, I want a made in the USA policy or a made in Uganda policy, whatever it is, we want to protect our industry, we want to protect our workers, we want to protect our businesses. You can't do that if you have an IMF program. And the third is budget cuts. You got to cut your budgets no matter what. Doesn't matter you're doing good, you're doing bad, your currency's strong, your currency's weak. You have to cut your budgets. And of course, you know, politics being what it is, governments don't cut military budgets, they cut budgets for schools, hospitals, roads and bridges and other things. So this is really meant to devastation.
I saw this come. It was April of 10, you know, the leaders of the BRICS, you know, were discussing the possibility of using IMF special drawing rights as a global currency. And if they wanted to do that, the dollar, okay? I can feel it coming. Now, then you have in July 16th of this month, this year, you know, they're looking to the New Development Bank and Contingent Reserve Arrangement, CRA, to be centered around the United Nations for Systemic Legitimacy, the same as was facilitated back in 44. Now, both of these BRICS institutions are meant to facilitate the global processes of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, but you know, you hear quotes coming out of them. They say, and this just happened recently, and I think this is your 2 weeks ago thing, we are pleased to announce the signing of the treaty for the establishment of the BRICS contingent reserve arrangement with an initial size of 100 U.S. billion. Okay? So I'm going, okay, this arrangement will have a positive precautionary effect, help countries forestall short-term liquidity pressures, promote further cooperation, yada, 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 and complement existing international arrangements. So my thing is, I'm going BRICS. It seems to me like they just want to be, I don't know, a new senior partner in the law, the same law firm or something.
Yeah, we got to understand the history here. I mean, part of the history is back in 2008, you remember George Bush Jr. on his way out of office called an emergency meeting, including all these countries, emergency meeting of the G20. It was the first time the heads of state of the G20 came. And basically, he begged China and India and Brazil for money. And they said, yeah, we'll give you some money if you give us a seat at the IMF, at the IMF and World Bank. They also talked about a seat at the UN Security Council. Bush said, can't do Security Council, sorry about that, but we'll definitely do the IMF and the World Bank. And he never, I mean, it's not just Bush, it's the other G7 countries as well. They never lived up to their promise. So as a result of not living up to their promise, now we have a situation where they could have been invited to have a seat at the table, and I think maybe that's part of this game is what they want. But because they're not getting a seat at the table, they say, okay, we set up our own table. And by the way, you're not invited.
Well, so, then, that's just like, you know what? We changed our mind. We got a nice little a seat right here. You know, give you a nice little padded chair.
Yeah.
Join the club.
Yeah, it's a lot of it is still negotiation. I mean, we don't know because the IMF is still talking about, you know, giving them more shares and so on. So we don't know if there's going to be we know that there will be more changes to the IMF board and representation and so on. But,
okay,
but now that we've got this agreement, I think it's going to be hard to stop.
Okay.
This is going forward, and the question will just be how much it challenges the status quo.
Okay. This is man, we found the right guy. Huh? I'd go to India, but we found the right guy. We're going to find, man, we're going to drill down. You know, and go to the archive, because I'm going to ask some stuff, you know, and get through some stuff that you probably don't care about and some stuff in the break. We'll be right back. Okay, Samir, this is, you know, being inside, what I just have starting to come to realize, you've been living, okay? So, I mean, I'm going to help you out here in America, and, you know, the Lovelution is going to, you know, get learnified and everything you want to tell them, all right? So this is a good opportunity for you, but I need to get back to the status quo and some history. Probably other people aren't as interested in the history, and I am, because how we got here just did not happen all by itself. But there is a goal behind it, and the goal is, it's like you said, it's just another version of colonization. You know, it's just how did your, livestock not get inside our fence? Well, we go put them inside a fence. Here, let me build a fence. And now your livestock in it and we get a cut. So I'm just going, this is not good. And I'm thinking that the BRICS, their whole thing was, oh, you're not treating us as an equal. We don't want to be a junior partner anymore. We want to be a senior partner. And how we get to be a senior partner is threaten to open our own law firm. Okay, so I mean, that's what I'm seeing is going on. Did the BRICS ever intend on really completing the process and having their own monetary system, or does the West or United States threaten them with freaking aircraft carriers? I mean, what is the threat?
Yeah.
Why do they not?
I mean, it's not just the discussion on the monetary system isn't really happening in the BRICS anymore. It's happening in the G20, and there it is potentially interesting, with SDRs being a possibility. But also, I don't think SDRs are a genuine possibility anymore.
Why?
I think it's a basket of, they're talking about a basket of currencies.
I know, but why not SDR? Why not the basket of currencies? Why?
I'm not sure exactly. I think it's dropped off. I think the basket of currencies has replaced the SDRs as the proposal on the table. But we'll see. In Australia in November, we'll see where those negotiations go. It's no longer high on the agenda.
Well, I thought the SDRs were a basket of currencies. I thought it kind of equated to the same thing.
Yeah, maybe, but not a big enough basket. I think SDRs are favored towards sort of three currencies, the pound, the euro, and the dollar. And I think they're talking about a bigger basket of currencies, which would include the Chinese currency, would include Brazil. I'm not sure about the status of Russia, given the complications with Russian.
Okay, so the new agreement, you know, we get past Bretton Woods and all this other stuff back in the day after World War II, is all of a sudden they're going, yeah, we got to include these guys in our club too, damn it. But it's going to be the same thing. It's going to be a world currency. I mean, that's what's coming.
No, I wish it were. No. What's coming is the continued reign of the U.S. dollar. A world currency would actually make a lot more sense.
Explain this to me. When we come back, we'll talk about that very thing right there. But I'm getting the impression that I guarantee they want to have, we control whatever the hell the currency is, okay? And I'm going, all right, the initial IMF creation and the World Bank and the Bank of International Settlements and the central banks of the West, I need a hierarchy understanding. I need and what the hell does United Nations have to do with, you know, with this? I mean, it's like they're going to the United Nations. We need to have a systemic legitimacy. What? You know, who the hell even does that? And why the United Nations? You know, what is there some, you know, they put a sword on their shoulder and say, you have systemic legitimacy? I mean, where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, I think the IMF, I mean, sorry, the UN is more legitimate than the IMF or the World Bank, man. I mean, it's something that everyone, every nation has a say in, right? It's something that you can vote on. And it has councils that were set up by agreement of most countries, right?
Okay, so we're coming back.
In terms of the legitimacy of these forums, IMF or the World Bank is way less legitimate than the UN, right?
Okay, we're coming back. I want you to help me understand that. Would you please?
Sure.
All right, here we go.
Cover our satellite costs with the chip in on the right side of the page at lrn.fm.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800.
Okay, off air, Samir and I are yakking a little bit. You know, he'd prefer a world currency. It'd be better to have a world currency. I mean, I would ask the question if you would like to, you know, not have competition, because I'm like, have your world currency. I don't give a crap. I'll just do Bitcoin. Nope, not allowed. BitLicense is part of the world currency, and you're underneath and it's ours now, whatever it is. Well, he believes that there's going to be domination as it was before the U.S. dollar, and he'll call it whatever, but it'll be the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think we got to understand what the problem is. Before you find the solution, you got to diagnose the problem. Now, what's the problem is that you have the U.S. dollar playing an inordinately strong role in global currency markets. Number one. Number two, you have global currency markets that are incredibly volatile, with people writing computer programs to buy and sell currencies based on minor fluctuations, right? So you have currency prices going all over the place, everything tied to the U.S. dollar. So what this happens, there are two problems there. One is if something happens to the dollar, if the dollar gets too strong or gets too weak, it just throws the whole system into whack. The other problem is if I'm a particular country and I'm doing something that, you know, investors maybe question. So if I'm Malaysia in, say, 1999 or whatever, maybe Indonesia in 1997 or Thailand or whatever, sometimes it can be genuine. In Thailand, there was a housing bubble. But in some of these countries, it's just the case that, you know, capital started to flee and we're still not really sure why. And the result was a run on the currency and the result was complete disaster, right? So this is the world that we're living in. You can put in capital controls. If we had capital controls in place, which wouldn't allow the buying and selling of currencies at that kind of pace, you know, we could control a lot of this. But moving back to a world with capital controls is going to be very difficult, okay? So that would have been one solution. The easiest solution was capital controls, not on the table, right? What's the next best solution? The next best solution is, instead of having things tied to a single currency, have things tied to something else, some other arbitrary currency. I don't know what it is.
How about gold?
SDRs was one possibility of this. This is special drawing rights of the IMF that you already mentioned. But the third thing, and perhaps more the more logical thing, is to take a weighted average of the major currencies of the world, say the 20 most traded currencies in the world, and say that weighted average is going to determine for everyone else who's not part of that 20. It's going to determine how you trade in and out of your country, right? So I'm not saying these are perfect solutions. They all have problems. But the current situation is so bad that we need to take some steps forward. And the step forward that we need to take is to reduce dependency on the U.S. dollar.
Okay, why?
And I think creating a kind of currency basket is one way to do that.
Why is gold so... That's what made the dollar so dominant to begin with. I mean, it was
good as
gold.
I think you're not correct.
Okay, why? Why a commodity is not a pick? We're going to do this dial turning and people sitting at tables and in charge. Let the free market determine whatever is. And, you know, and tie it to freaking, I don't know, cotton. I don't care. But tie it to something. You know, I mean, gold always worked out pretty good. Why the aversion to that?
Yeah, listen, I'm not an expert, man, but I tell you that in general, commodity prices tend to fluctuate more than other kinds of prices. So when we look at inflation indices, we'll have one inflation index that includes commodity prices and one inflation index that doesn't. And the one that doesn't include commodity prices always fluctuates less than the one with commodity prices. So if we're talking about going back to a system that's you know, I think you have to complicate the story. The U.S. dollar dominated because, A, the U.S. wrote the rules of the game after World War II with the Bretton Woods Agreement, but, B, because there really was no economy standing, right? I mean, everyone else was destroyed by the war, or they were destroyed by colonialism, or both, right? So, you know, there's no alternative, frankly, at that point in time, from 1948 to 1971. There's very little alternative to the U.S. dollar dominating. Yes, it happened to be tied to gold. That's true. But if it wasn't tied to gold, it would still have dominated.
That's a whole other economic discussion front. Because I see when you say commodity prices going up and down, no, that's the currency. You know, the commodity still buys me the same now as it did 50 years ago. You know, so so we'll discuss that another time. But what I wanted to get from you is the history. So help me out. After World War II, we got the United Nations comes up, and for this systemic legitimacy, what the hell that means. But I'm going, what level is the, you know, Bank of International Settlements and the World Bank and the IMF? Give me the hierarchy. Who the hell are these people?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you who they are, but I can't tell you why. I can tell you that they're very important, but I can't tell you why they're very important, because I think it's very
arbitrary.
What's
the level? Who's underneath what? I mean, you know,
So what we have is we have a system whereby the IMF kind of rules on a lot of things. If a country is in debt, if a country needs a loan, if it's not in good standing with the IMF, it will not be able to get new money, new borrowings to pay off old borrowings.
Okay,
right?
But where did the IMF come from? Where did the IMF come from? Who are they? And how were they created?
So this was an agreement exactly 70 years ago. In fact, I think it was 70 years ago this week. I think it's July 25th or something like this. In Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, an agreement basically where the U.S. told Britain, hey, the pound is out. You guys are dead. We're taking over. It's going to be the U.S. dollar, and we're going to write the rules of the game. And they set up this International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The International Monetary Fund, if you read the Articles of Incorporation, was set up to do the opposite of what it does to some extent. It was set up to limit trading on currencies and to tie trading on currencies to the U.S. dollar and to tie the U.S. dollar to gold. The U.S. dollar was tied to gold internally. That's a different story. So that was what the IMF was set up to do, but in the late 1970s and early 1980s, it started doing the opposite, which was to force people to open up their currencies, not to peg it to the U.S. dollar or to anything else.
They couldn't.
Just let investors come and go and buy and sell as they like.
When they went off during the Nixon administration in the early 70s and they, you know, kind of, we're not on the gold standard anymore, that is when it started. I mean, that was, here we go.
That's you can say that's the foundation, but actually, you can look at the other end of the 1970s for what I see as the real starting point, and that's the Volcker shock. So what you had is you had these countries that were borrowing and had huge U.S. dollar-denominated debts. I don't know why. It was very foolish of them to do that. But most developing countries, especially big developing countries, had U.S. dollar-denominated debt. Paul Volcker increased inflation or increased interest rates, an order of magnitude, something unbelievable. I'm not going to remember it off the top of my head.
Oh, it was in the high teens. The 30-year treasury was 15-point-something%, and now it's at nothing. I mean, you know. Yeah.
So it went from fairly low throughout the 70s to about 20%. And what that did was it put that together with the oil crisis, where countries that weren't exporting oil had to pay a lot more for their oil. That put a lot of countries into a state of high debt. And that's debt that the IMF then took over. So this was debt owed to commercial banks. The commercial banks went to the IMF and said, hey, look, we're not going to get our money back. Why don't you take these debts and you get the money back?
So an international bailout.
It was a kind of an international bailout, but an international bailout not of the countries, which may have made some sense, because it's not the country's fault that Volcker raised the interest rates. But it was a bailout of the companies, of the banks, who should have paid their losses. If they made debts that couldn't be honored, if I borrow from a bank and I turn out to be a bad risk, I mean, you can send me to jail, but you know, if I ain't got the money, I ain't got the money, right? So, and the bank has to take the loss, right? So, anyway, so this was, at least that's a theory in a capitalist system. So this was socialism for the rich and a really harsh kind of austerity capitalism for everyone else.
No, we
led
did.
To
we
riots
went through
in
this.
Senegal in 1979, led to riots in Mexico in 1981, led to IMF bread riots throughout the developing world.
No, we went through this. We lived it here in 08. All of a sudden now, instead of the United States taxpayer and citizens here benefiting from how we're exploiting the rest of the world, they didn't like it none too much when we got exploited, okay? So it's happening, and it's just crunching down on everything to the point that the BRICS forms and says, hey, you know, we're going to do it ourselves, and then you find out they're doing the same thing with the same people. They're just getting a nice chair. So I'm going, what the heck?
I mean, listen, I still got hope on the BRICS stuff. I'll tell you why I still got hope. Because we have this history, we have another history that we haven't talked about, of the so-called colonized and occupied peoples, who said we're going to get together. They formed different formations, including the G77, and they said we're not going to listen to these trade rules. On the case of the G77, we're going to make our own trade rules. We're going to make rules that actually benefit working people, benefit ordinary citizens. And so it's this hope that the G77 and the BRICS will somehow come together and will help to chart a new course. It's that possibility that gives me hope that we could see something different.
All right, we're going to talk more about, you know, is there hope? You know, I'm like, you look a little uppity over there, and slaves are made in such ways. Peace is made, no, slaves are made in such ways. I see some slave making coming. Yeah, this is, the more I find out about this, the more I'm getting the impression it's the same old, same old, same old, here we go again. You know, I'm glad you're there to, you know, kind of, you know, at least put some chronology on this and help us understand it. But I don't know, are you wishful thinking? Do you have evidence that you think that there's still going to be a good opportunity for the BRICS and their organizations, or are you just hopeful, or what?
Yeah, there's a couple of straws to cling to. I got to say, after this last summit in Brazil, I'm not that hopeful. But there's a couple of straws that I still cling to in my hopeful moments. So one is that all of these countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, they're all countries that haven't accepted all this austerity stuff and so on completely. They're countries that haven't accepted the Washington consensus completely. They're countries that still have industrial policies. There's countries that have built up infrastructure. In the case of China, it's a country that's lifted, you know, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, despite the fact that China has all kinds of other problems that we can talk about too, right? So there are some good models within the BRICS to talk about. That's one thing that gives me hope.
But all that's negotiation. I mean, it's just, you don't have this austerity, and it's got to be on the table when negotiating. You have, and this is now you do. You know, I mean, it's just all that is up for negotiation. I've seen it since 10. How long has it been? It's been four
years.
It's
pretty clear these guys aren't going to impose conditions. And that's not only the kind of conditions that I find harmful, but it's also sort of positive conditions. Like, you know, don't kill anyone to make a project, or don't move anyone to make a project, right? So what they say is, on the one hand, they say we're not going to condition lending on those kind of safeguards. But what we are going to do is we're going to base our lending in the so-called principles of sustainable development that came out of the 1992 Rio Declaration, which is a pretty good document. So the question is, okay, that's rhetoric, and here's reality. How do we make the two match? And I haven't seen anyone articulate, or certainly no official has given me an answer to the question of how the good rhetoric and the bad reality are going to match up.
See, this
but the hope is that they can find a way.
Samir, I'm looking at these meetings, and you see people, okay? And it's not even that many people. You guys represent, what, God, man, over half the population of the planet. You know, you're going, you know, and we want that doesn't matter. And it's like Congress, you know, the United States government is ruled by 500 and something guys that they just got to buy off. You know, I'm going, so you have these, instead of the people having a voice, you've given it over to BRICS, which is a bunch of suits going somewhere. And all I got to do is give them green fees to golf courses and hookers, and they get wherever the hell they want.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an element of corruption here. There's no doubt about it. But I mean, look, even the least accountable governments still have to listen to what their people want, you know? So
They're in the streets, how'd that work out for Greece?
It's a question of how we can mobilize people, how you can mobilize people in the U.S., to carry forth a certain agenda of sustainable development and jobs and growth and whatever you need in the U.S. And it's a question of how we in developing countries can mobilize our people to hold our leaders accountable.
How much
it's
do you know
easy,
about...
It's certainly possible.
How much do you know about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and stuff? Does that ever come up to you guys?
No, not my cup of tea, no. But I can, you know, happy to think about it as someone with a lot of economics training.
Well, see, the thing is that it just immediately, it starts skyrocketing here, and people said, you know, that's, you know, peace out. You guys do whatever the hell you want. We'll just do our own people's currency. We got it ourselves. We don't need an institution. We don't need hands laid on it. We don't need sanctions. We just did it and bite me. And they go, oh, hell no. So what happens, it comes out of the Department of Financial Services in New York and says, you know what? We just passed a law that says you got to have they're proposing the law, you know, that you got to have a license to even create competition with us. Oh, heck no, we can see where this is going. This is the people doing it that you're not allowed. You know, and I'm going, oh. So then I started seeing how it was seen. It was just another block of people, a regional currency. All right, here we go.
.fm.
Freedom is the answer. What's the question?
I want to break free.
You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free.
From?
I want to break free from your lies. You're so self-satisfied.
Lies, 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 lies. I'm so sick of it. But here you got someone gonna, you know what? We're gonna help you. We're gonna help, you know, half of the, at least, if not more, half of the planet's population represented by Russia, China, India, South Africa, Brazil. I mean, these are very populous countries. You know, it's a couple billion, hell, almost half is freaking in China. You know, you got, Russia is not small, lots of resources, as does have China. You know, Brazil, and it's enormous. You have, South Africa, it's on the African continent. So we got, you know, South America. We have parts of Africa. We got Asia definitely covered, you know, and parts of Europe. I'm going, man, this is an opportunity to do some ass whipping. But the thing is, they go, yeah, we're going to whip some ass. We're going to whip ass. And how many hookers do I get? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well, we can be friends. Make us a senior partner in the We Rule the Planet people, and we're all in. And I'm going, wow. And you create an organization, sooner or later, the organization becomes more important than the reason you created it. Every single time. Are we starting to, you know, you feeling that, Samir? Samir Dosani from ActionAid.org trying to get equality, you know, on the planet for people. Are you feeling that's what's happening?
Yeah, listen, I mean, there's two agendas going on here. One is very much, you know, give us a seat at the table, as I said. You know, the BRICS countries asking for a seat at the UN Security Council, asking for a seat, more votes at the IMF board. So that's definitely part of it. But there's also another history, which is the history that all of these countries come from, which is, except Russia. Russia is kind of a unique history. But let's take Russia out of the equation. All the other countries have a history of colonial past. And we have the anti-colonial sort of framework. We have groups like the G77. We have groups like the Non-Aligned Movement. Well, what did these groups say when they had their Bandung conference in Indonesia in 1955? What did these countries say to each other? They were just leaving the stranglehold of colonialism. They said, look, we're not going to be able to develop. You know, if you think we can break the stranglehold of colonialism in 10 years or 20 years, it's not going to happen. This is a long-term project, number one. Number two, the bigger countries, that means your China's, your India's, your Brazil's, these are the countries that actually are going to have more leverage because they have more resources, they have more people, they can get more stuff done. So these are the countries that are going to have to lead the way. But by the way, leading the way doesn't mean you turn into another colonizer, right? Leading the way means you lead us all together, right? Maybe you take a step in front, but you make sure your brothers and sisters in smaller countries are that step behind you, right? So this is the question. Will the BRICS countries really, you know, make an agreement with groups like the G77? Will they make agreements with smaller countries to sort of say, look, we're going forward, we're giving you loans without these conditions, but on the condition that we are, you know, that it is a new model of sustainable development, that this is not continuing the mistakes of the past. So, you know, here's this opportunity, and if you want to walk with us, you can. You don't have to. But here's this opportunity, so come along and see how far you can go. If it can be that tool of solidarity as opposed to domination, then I have a lot of hope here.
Well, is there any evidence after spending a few years with this that that's what's going to happen? I mean, what just happened in Brazil?
I mean, the evidence is, as you rightly point out, the evidence is going in, is looking in the opposite direction. But, you know, this is a bank that hasn't made any loans, right? This is a contingency reserve agreement that hasn't released a single dollar as yet. So, and it's possible, you know, it's a disappointing that its loans will be made in dollars, but it's not the end of the world. There are still interesting things it could do. So, you know, yes, let's be critical and let's look at this critically, but as yet it hasn't moved, you know, hasn't moved forward, it hasn't moved backwards. So it's a little too early for us to judge, and what I'm expressing is a critical kind of optimism.
No, let me tell you how I see it. This is, I'm going, wow, I know what this is. It's Lord of the Rings. You create all these rings, you give them to people, and one to bind them. And how you have the one ring to bind them is you got to get them all on the same ring. The dollar, okay? So I'm just going, this is not good. It's not. And from the beginning, when I started seeing just this month, it became very clear to me what the BRICS is really about. They were pissed off. We represent half the population of the planet, and we're still in colonial Earth, you know? And we get to have some kind of a say and be part of, and they go, okay, well, it's like dealing with union bosses or something, you know? And the people do not get a say. This is not them. And whenever you do get the people have any kind of say, it's always they got some development, you know, program for your country and austerity, which means your legislature can't pass and do, you got to do what we want. And it's like the Queen's Privy Council or something. It said, you know, how in the hell did the Queen of England get on the money of Australia, New Zealand, Canada? I mean, how the hell does that even happen? You know? And what's the tie there? Well, it's the same thing. The people don't get to have a say. And they start going, hey, yo, we do want a say. Well, in Greece, what happens? You have a bunch of people in the streets going, what's up? So this is, you start doing that with China and India, you know, and Brazil, I'm going, you're going to have you some problems. I guarantee it. The people will have a say. And then they start coming into cryptocurrencies. It's a people's currency. Nope. It's just another regional currency. We're going to put it in a law and we got guns. You know, I'm going, this is you create an organization in support of the people, sooner or later the organization becomes more important than the people. Sooner or later.
Yeah.
And it looks like sooner. Yeah. Now it only took 4 years.
Maybe. I mean, like I say, we haven't seen this thing do anything one way or another. I mean, the other thing I'll say to what you're going on about right now is that, listen, I mean, yeah, currencies are important, but currencies aren't the be all and end all. There are other things we can talk about, right? I mean, the main thing for me is, you know, how are people if we talk about the basics of economics, what does the production look like? What does the consumption look like? And what does the transportation look like? How are we moving between consumption and
I'm
production?
I'm for a
right?
leave me aloneism. So, I so just the want the is, people to be free to do whatever they want. Let them. Yeah, you know, I don't care.
You know, I mean, if the people are free to starve on the streets, that's not much freedom. You know what I'm saying? So we got to find a way, given our current economy, we got to find a way whereby everyone can be part of this network, this economy, and so on, right? So, I mean, I live in a country where people are starving, where I live with the reality of starvation. I live with the reality of, yeah, you can leave people alone, but, you know, that's not going to solve.
It's because of this system that has done that. If you left them alone, what's the biggest complaint that the farmers in India have is all these agreements that they did to make them starve. What, I mean,
sure.
You don't know
sure,
that?
Sure, sure.
I mean, seriously.
No, I mean, absolutely. The WTO has made life more miserable for Indian farmers, but life for Indian farmers was no picnic before that, right? So what we need is, you know, we can talk about utopia. We can talk about different models. We can talk about Gandhi had a communitarian, you know, anarchist kind of model. We can talk about libertarian models. No problem. We can talk about what those look like. But in the reality that we have today, we have the reality of a country like India versus the reality of a country like China, right? 20 years ago, 30 years ago, same number of people, same number of poor people. China had more poor people and had more people, in fact, then. What we have today, China, for all of its faults, has reduced poverty by 50%, has reduced global poverty by 50%, right? Has reduced its internal poverty by a huge amount. What are the issues in China? They're middle class issues. People want to have more than one kid right now. right? Which I would, I mean, yeah, it's not just a middle class issue, but it's the kind of issue that I'm hearing expressed by young middle class people. Let's put it that way. You know, the issues are not people dying on the street of hunger. Let's put it that way.
Okay, but
whereas
before
in India,
we run
what's
out...
the issue? The issue is we haven't invested in a development strategy. We haven't invested in schools. We haven't invested in hospitals. We haven't invested in these things. And the state has a key role to play in all of this. The state has a key role to play.
Before we run out of time, what's the next step that you think you're looking, you know, for what's going to happen? Did I lose him? Damn it. That was a good question. There he is. I got you back, Samir.
Sorry, drop that.
Okay. Now, what are we looking at as the next step in the future? You know, what's going to happen? What are you looking for? What's the next meeting? What's the next nail in the coffin?
Yeah, let's see. I mean, these guys are going to set up a headquarters in Shanghai and a regional office in Johannesburg. Let's see what it all looks like. I mean, I think we could be looking at, you say, as you say, at more nails in the coffin. But, you know, we never know. It could be a pleasant surprise as well. And I think it's up to all of us to not just be observers, but to be actors in this process and to say, look, we're demanding a better world, and this is what we think it should look like.
I looked at India and what happened with the movement behind Gandhi and this peaceful, passive, leave-me-aloneism. That was the solution. We saw the solution, an inspiration to the planet, for history, for all time of the galaxy, and it's not even considered an option. It's no, we got to agree to some agreement with new agreeers. I'm going, what? I thought that was the whole point that we were trying to get away from.
Yeah, Gandhian economics is a really interesting system, but unfortunately it's never really been tried, including in the Gandhian movement. So, you know, look, I'm all for these communes, I'm all for trying new stuff, I'm all for, yeah, alternative currencies, absolutely. But, you know, we live in a world of nation states, and given that we live in a world of nation states where nation states have responsibilities and obligations in addition to power and sort of rights, they don't have rights, they have power, we have to hold them accountable for the power that they have.
You know, Samir, I think you just solved the problem right there. Get rid of the nation states. Get down to people. Just people, people, people controlling. People in charge of their own lives. People.
I think if you get rid of corporations as well, I'm 100% on board with that.
Yeah, because corporations ain't people.
More dangerous than nation states right now.
No more corporations is people. You know, Samir, you know, hold on a second. I want to talk to you. I tell you, man, this was great. I'm really appreciative of the new contact to help us understand from the boots on the ground on this issue.
Why did you move to the Shire?
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Thank you very much. You know, I'm hoping that you'll make yourself available as this process goes on. Please keep in contact with Donna. She's going to be sending you an archive of the show in about a few hours after we get done and then editing and so on. And she'll send you the link, and you can use it and do what you want with it. But I tell you,
okay, sounds like good. Sounds
make
like
sure you keep in touch with us, because I see this develop. I already know where this goes. I've been through this so many times. I've been an activist since the late 80s. I'm, you know, like one of you, okay? But I'm telling you, there is a pattern, and it's how did your slaves, you know, get to be our slaves? Let me see. I got an agreement for you, okay? And that's what happens. Every time, the people get negotiated out of their own individual power, but the real power is in individuals just being able to do what they want and negotiate. I'll give you an example. The cryptocurrencies, you know, the Bitcoin thing, and how it works.
Sorry, I got to run, man. I got a daughter with fever, man. If we're
I apologize.
I got to take off, man.
Hey, well, thanks for spending time with me.
All right, take care, man.
Bye-bye. Bye. Donna, go ahead and... Wait, hold on a second. Hold on a second. You know, the one thing that I wanted to express to him before we go in the next hour was that the ability of individuals to be able to do whatever they want outside of any kind of control or a border, that makes all the mullahs, all of the, you know, the rabbis, the priests, the popes, the governments, the presidents, the legislatures, it takes them out of the equation. And that's what cryptocurrency provides, is that individuals, you know, I want to order something from a 17-year-old kid in Tehran, Shanghai, you know, wherever the heck, and I want to be able to get it, and it gets delivered, and I'm done. And we just are on, you know, smartphone, and, you know, on the loincloth of an 8-year-old in Congo, and all of a sudden he's banked, and we don't need the man. This is, whenever you have this consolidation, and all these consolidations just want to be at the same table of the consolidation of everybody else. And I'm going, that's not better. It's not. It's not. I advocate for the power of the individual. The individual. That's my hope. And it's going to come sooner or later. You know, sooner or later, after we all kind of educate ourselves, because we can. with the internet, and it's going to be, you know, some other net and some other form of communication, the satellite-based mesh network, UHF, bounce off the moon, whatever the heck. We're going to be able to just communicate between ourselves. And when that happens, it's going to be bright. But we got to get, in the end, freedom always wins. It just gets really messy first. We'll be right back. David?
Yep.
Okay.
Good morning.
This is, I just had in the last hour, I had on a guy, Samir Dasani from, works with trying to negotiate with the BRICS, negotiating with the West, okay? And this is, he's out of India, and we were talking to him from India, actionaid.org, that's what it is, and getting an understanding of the status quo and who and did and what and everything. Did you read... did you happen to see my article that I did over the weekend, Black and White Bitcoin, the update and whatever?
Yeah, I saw it briefly.
Okay. The point that I'm making is I started doing some research on this. I can see what's going on, in my opinion. The BRICS are trying to get a seat at the table, and we control an international and monetary and the loans, and how did all your slaves not our slaves, and now they're our slaves kind of thing. And I'm going, okay, Bitcoin is seen as just another regional currency. It's like another group of people that's not by borders or under some constituency or something. And what they did is they said, you know what? We need to get Bitcoin under control because it represents, you know, all of these, you know, more people, and the unbanked can be banked. You got Muslim women and children under age and out in the Congo, and all you need to do is Sally Struthers get the little 8-year-old Congo kid with a big belly on his loincloth. He's got a smartphone. All of a sudden now he's in the banking system. And I'm going, I can see what's going on. Now, as you know, you're talking about working with Made Safe and want to make sure, I mean, I need to know who that is. Who are the people and what code do you want to put in? What's the negotiation and why and how and this? And then the licensing thing. I see what it is. I mean, I did enough research, I can get it. I go, holy shit. This is just another, you know, instead of it being a country that they're going after, it's a generation. It is people that aren't represented by a country. They're represented by a philosophy or an ability, and they use the anarchists to, you know, bring us in. All right, here we go. We'll talk about it.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Today, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Because we're informed! Oh, man, I tell you, I did a lot. This weekend, I spent, well, a lot. I mean, you know, 2-3 hours, I'm sitting there kind of looking and then writing an article and adding to and kind of, and I go, oh, hell no. Hell no. I wrote that, I was Wednesday night, Thursday, I think it was. It was after I had had Paul Snow on and Jeffrey Tucker. And Paul Snow, Jeffrey Tucker, and I go, okay, I see what's going on. You know, the following day on Friday, we had 2 hours of Cody Wilson and Daniel Larimer from BitShares.org, and then Cody Wilson on Dark Wallet, and had an exchange with Amir Taki a little bit the night before and so on. And I'm going, yeah, I think I need to warn these guys. I don't think you guys understand who what. You're dealing with the big, giant, you know, red, he's got horns and blood dripping fang pointy tail guys, man. I mean, these are evil. I know, with a big giant E. So I'm going, they got their pinky up to their, you know, corner of their mouth and everything. And I'm going, there is something going on that I do not understand. I want to understand. Let's understand it. And as I start going through and I find out, we just had a guy from India on, Samir, what's his last name? Dasani from Action freedomaid.org dealing with, and he goes just a couple of, July 16th, it came out, and they're, yep, you know, they're going to go use the U.S. dollar, funded it with $100 billion, do it kind of, they're in the club now, and here's your hookers and green fees, and now all your people, half the population of the planet is now going to be on the plantation along with everybody else, but you get a nice leather-bound chair. Okay, so I'm going, okay, how does Bitcoin fit into that? They're just another jurisdiction. They're just another group of people. They're just, how are these people being able to trade with themselves without anybody's permission? How are we going to keep them under control? They're so freaking not allowed. Do a bit license. You know, this is, a lot of people go, it would never happen. They can't do that. Ernie, you're crazy. Ernie, you're crazy. They can't do that. Technology, they can't. And I go, yeah, well, they just did. David Johnston from bitangels.co. BitAngels is, on, and it's been very kind of David to come on and explain stuff to us. But I'll tell you, David, explain to me, what your relationship was. You worked with these guys at the Bitcoin Foundation. You're kind of being nice to what's-his-face over at the New York Department of Financial Services or whatever. They kind of, and then they twisted the knife in your back. Okay, they already had it laid in place there. They just twisted. Okay, so help me out and understand, this whole bit license thing from the beginning. We got lots to talk about. Go.
Well, I think Ben and the regulations, quote unquote, that he's proposing are basically going to kill financial technology in the New York jurisdiction for a decade. I think probably Andreas Antonopoulos has had the best analogy for a disruptive technology that came along in the past and the status quo tried to stop it. He used the example of the Red Flag Act, which was passed in the UK in 1865, which this was about the time of the infancy of the car, and the railroads and the stagecoaches industries were all afraid that the car would disrupt their monopoly business that they had set up. And so they got the government to pass this ridiculous law that said every car had to have a person driving it, it had to have an engineer to operate it, and it had to have a person walking in front of the car, waving red flags, warning people that this, infernal machine was coming down the road and might cause them harm. And it basically had the effect of destroying innovation in the UK for 30 years. During the development of the car. I mean, they should have probably had Henry Ford in the UK, right? They were the leaders in the Industrial Revolution at that point, and they had all the reasons in the world that they were going to win the race to develop the best cars. But because of that law, it basically crippled innovation in the UK.
And well, that instead, was the purpose.
Exactly. Well, that's the whole point. That was the purpose. And so I think what we see here is it's existing monopoly players pushing to have this new technology not be able to reach its full potential, certainly in their backyard of New York, and to push it away from New York because they figure they can slow it down the way they normally do with regulation.
And that's the purpose. What, I'm wondering what the thought process was by even working with these guys in New York. I mean, I know, all right, let's go ahead and do a little bit of history. I first meet you at the Texas Bitcoin Conference. We had like a week or two before at the Freedom Summit. Paul Snow and Rafael Rodriguez that put on the Texas Bitcoin Conference, came to our, sure, our summit. Their whole thing is we need wide adoption. We got to work with the man. Yeah, we need a line on our IRS form that says capital gains on Bitcoin goes here, we need to have you blah, 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 because it'll free the planet, cuz. And I'm going, no, it won't. You dance with the devil, you don't change him. Well, guess what the hell happened? And I'm wondering when it happened. How was it that Bitcoin, somebody somewhere thought that it was a good idea to negotiate with the man, which was the whole point of Bitcoin? Explain that to me.
Well, I don't think we're going to gain a lot by negotiating with regulators. I tend to fall in the camp. I think Bruce Fenton gave a really good talk about this at the San Francisco Coin Congress just recently.
I had it up on Freedom's Phoenix. I watched the whole thing, and he's like, ignore him. We're not going to be dealing with these guys anymore, and I'm not even sure if he's for like going to another alt currency or just screw him.
Well, it's just not productive, right? I mean, guys like Ben Wasky come in and you know, they say nice words and they, you know, tell the community, oh, we're here to help and all the rest of this stuff. But based on his actions, I mean, the laws that they're proposing with the bit license, so maybe we should back up just a little bit and for the benefit of the audience, if they haven't gotten the details already. It's basically this onerous proposed regulation coming out of New York that says every Bitcoin merchant and every Bitcoin company has to get a license, they have to get fingerprinted, they have to spend millions of dollars on compliance, all these ridiculous things that startups aren't going to be able to do. And so it's going to knock everybody out of New York except for the big boys, some of the largest companies, and of course the banks are exempt.
No, it was worse than that. It was if Satoshi Nakamoto, whatever his name is, if he was to write Bitcoin now, it would be illegal. I mean,
sure,
you know, if
you
they pass this law.
You can't create a new currency. You can't issue a new currency without being licensed.
And the thing is, Ben guy, yeah, he's just a kid. He's just the insulation. He's just the front man. He just understood something about and say the words about cryptocurrency, and I'll go meet with the guys and smile and shake hands and be cool and party with them and smoke some dope. And then all of a sudden, he's like, and he's the messenger. To think it's him, he's just insulation. You think it's Ben?
Sure.
Seriously?
No, of course. I mean, he answers to the people that are going to fund, you know, his political office, and they're people that already hold the monopoly in New York. I mean, most regulation, this is the case, right? Regulation doesn't just pop out of the ether or because some bureaucrat gets initiative. It's because folks that want the regulation, mostly large banks, that they're pushing it and paying for it. That's how all regulation, all legislation in the country, and every country gets written. So, no, I don't believe he's the person behind it. I think, you know, obviously there are special interests that are pushing for this, you know, lobbyists, but, you know, he's the guy that's the front man.
Okay, I'm hoping that the libertarians, the freedom-oriented anarchists saw what, and the promise of what Bitcoin was, the promise of we get the free earth, the promise of, like, people, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of people across the planet unbanked, you know, in developing countries, and say, hey, all I got to need is my entire freaking village gets a smartphone, and we join the world economy with this app of kind of, woohoo, we're in, and they go, no, you're not allowed, because that is the point. That is the point. This is the one thing I, you know, we don't got to do this on live, but, you know, of course, you know, we got the archive. But the thing is that two things. One, I want to, when we get back, I'll mention the blockchain.info. All of a sudden, it gets added back to Apple. What the hell was behind that? You know, that one, it got off, and now it's back on. Somebody explain that to me. Then the other thing is that the help that BitAngels has to MadeSafe, in what form is that? And what, you know, requirement does that come in? And what, you know, is being added to the code to make sure? And I'm not feeling warm and fuzzy by the same people that was working with the foundation, want to be buddies with New York and everything, all of a sudden now helping MadeSafe. It make me feel better about that.
Okay. Well, I don't know the particular person that you're talking about. I mean, I'm a member of the foundation, but I didn't do any work with the foundation as far as...
Make me feel better about the same foundation working these boys, and kind of now I got one of the guys working on the MadeSafe thing, and I'm not feeling good about it. I mean, you know, the whole point of MadeSafe was to not have code in that you could be... It's like I'm looking at it right now. The BRICS are doing the same thing. I got 4 years ago, they come in and say, well, we're going to separate from, and they're not being playing fair and bite me. Then it gets up in, you know, influence, and all of a sudden they're like, ooh, they're a threat, and then all of a sudden they give them some green fees and hookers, and boom, now they're part of the IMF.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now tell me how it's different, David.
Sure. Well, I mean, the BitAngels is only providing capital. Nobody on the BitAngels is joined to the development team of MadeSafe, as far as I'm aware, and all of their code is open source, so everybody can review it. There's nobody in particular that's, you know, influencing the code that I'm aware of, and that's the whole point, like you say, is for MadeSafe to act independently and to give us these tools to decentralize everything.
Okay, you understand my concern. I mean, from an experienced activist, this isn't like, you know, sometimes it happens. It's every time it happens, okay? Mm-hmm. Every MFing single freaking time, and I just scratch the surface a little bit, and I go, yep, and there it is. And I'm looking at, so when we come back, you know, I'm going to dwell on that in the live, but I tell you this, I do want to hear about Apple's decision, all of a sudden, now blockchain.info is okay. What the hell happened to change their mind? Do you know?
I don't have any inside information. Hopefully it was pressure from the community, but if they struck some deal, I don't know about it.
Donna, see if you can get Andreas Antonopoulos on again. You know, bug the crap out of him. Talk about the Apple thing. He may want to talk about that. But you can see my concern. I've seen this, you know, these guys got hope for the BRICS. We're gonna finally free ourselves from, and it got funded with $100 billion U.S. are going to use the dollar now. Well, what the hell was the whole freaking point?
I hear you.
You should read my article, man. That was just, it didn't take me but a couple of hours to look, and I'm going, holy crap. And what helped a lot was SDR's talked about Murray Rothbard. Rothbard goes, oh, let me tell you what's going to happen. It's like Ron Paul doing speeches in the last 30 years, telling what's going to happen, then it happens, neon freaking I told you so. And I can see this negotiation with the government, you don't change them. So I'm wondering what the community, of which I know you're tapped into, and how their view on this is, on this licensing, because let's go and, you know, say, no, they shouldn't do that and stop them. I'm like, oh yeah, let's see how that works out, you know? So I'm just, ugh. All right, here we go.
Sure.
Listen to LRN.FM on any phone, anytime. 213-493-0309. That's 213-493-0309.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800. 602-264-2800. And now, Ernest Hancock.
Love is but a song we sing, fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring, or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing, and you may
it's an attitude. It's us. We are the problem. You know, this is that to think that, you know, those are being bad. They're not helping. You know, they're not allowing nothing. They're not. You just do it. And if I got to fight them, I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time. I don't want to fight them. If I don't have the technology and be able to kind of just, you know, bite me, I go do whatever the heck I want. I get a rocket ship. I go do my own growing in the backyard. I got a hydroponic of tomatoes. I got, you know, whatever. I mean, if I'm not allowed, if I can't figure out how I'm just going to do it, oh, and trade, using a currency that the man doesn't get to inflate or mess with or play with or license, or I'm like, you know, there is so much potential there, and I was always like, I would go, can they maintain, enhance, and expand their control and intrusiveness over your individual life? Can they? If they can, they will. And they go, no, they can't, Ernie. They can't. They can't. And I go, the hell they can't. They got a gun, all right? Well, the gun just came out. So I'm wondering, in the process here, David Johnston from BitAngel is going to help us understand, because he's been in the middle of this thing. Now, David, I know you're kind of the mind, okay, well, we can, you know, come together and get a voice and kind of, and even paid a freaking nano moment of attention to the man, and this is what happened. I need to know, from your perspective and others like you that were working on this project, wanting to develop the technology, you know, what's your feeling of dealing with the government now? Is it all about negotiating? Is it writing letters in the next 45 days to the man? What's your lobbying now?
Well, the fun thing about Bitcoin is Bitcoin is just math, and you can't point gun at math, and you can't, you can try to make algebra illegal, but it's not really effective. And so I would compare this to the whole copyright wars of the late 90s and the early 2000s. Copyright industry tried to crush Napster and all those similar technologies, and all that ended up happening is the centralized versions of those technologies like Napster went away, and what they got replaced with was things like BitTorrent, which by some estimations is now 20% of the internet volume goes over the BitTorrent network. And they've completely failed to stop the growth of sharing peer-to-peer between people, despite laws, despite arrests, despite different legal cases. And so, you know, the interesting thing about technology and what got me excited about Bitcoin is it's the same decentralized architecture. So they can write whatever they want on a piece of paper, but at the end of the day, people are going to be able to use this technology in a peer-to-peer way. And all they can do is shut down the centralized parts of the ecosystem, the exchanges or things like that, that have points of failure. But all that's going to do is encourage people to fully decentralize the projects that they're building. And so that's what I spend all of my time on, is the centralized infrastructure that can't be censored and that can't be shut down and that's completely peer-to-peer. I think that's where we ought to be spending our time.
Yes.
As developers.
Yeah, well, of course, and this is what I've been screaming, and I appreciate what you did, you know, by allowing me to address some of the hackers and talk to them, you know, in Texas, and I'm going, look, somebody needs to explain it to me. Why do we not have the elimination of contribution retribution? I need to be able to where I can move money around and it be anonymous and secret, and I can't believe, and the guy, Atlas, I think it was, wrote the book Anonymous Bitcoin, and he had a really good line in there, even though I think he's still kind of elitist, you know, it's for the techno geeky, your soccer mom doesn't get to play, but I'm going, look, I need to know why there is this lack of sense of urgency for this ability to bypass the system. And all of a sudden now I think the urgency got amped up again. Is there more development and give me my just button that I always wanted?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this gives people the real view of where regulations going to come in the Bitcoin ecosystem, and it's gotten a fire under every developer that they either have two choices now. Number one, if they stay with a centralized company, they have to block all of the IP addresses. They have to block all the users out of New York.
Oh, that is... I don't even want to... No, stop right there. This whole thing, it's going to be New York, and then they're going to do New Jersey, and then it's going to be whatever country of the kind of... And O and R, ones and zeros routed through New York to this
exactly.
one company, and you kind of...
Exactly.
And you're not allowed. That's just bullshit.
Exactly. So, if that option doesn't work, then your only other option is to decentralize what you're doing, so that there isn't a central entity that they can call or email or phone or contact in any way, and it's just software and it's just math, and people use it completely peer-to-peer. I think people, Andreas had a great quote on this. He told me once at a conference that people's first reaction to building technology on a decentralized platform is to build it centralized, and it's the wrong reaction. It's tougher to build decentralized systems. That's the easy answer here. It's tougher to build these robust systems, but that's the only thing that's really worthwhile.
Okay, we keep coming back to MadeSafe because it's the only place, other than maybe Tor or something, it's the only place that I've looked at where, from the beginning, you had an experienced coder that's more than 21 years old that looked at and goes, I can see what the problem is. I can see what the freaking problem is that everybody wants to do centralized or even decentralized but not distributed, and it's just software. So he works on it, he does it, it gets up there, and I can't, from my opinion, I don't want to be negative Nelly here, but I'm just like, I can't imagine the man allowing that to happen. I don't know how they'd stop it, you know, but if I got to fight them, we're doing it wrong, and they may be doing it right to where there is no fight. There's nothing to get. The software's already out. So I'm like, you know, help me feel better about this technology. Are we able to free ourselves?
Well, that's the beautiful thing about open source. So MadeSafe's code is all available for everyone to view. So there's no problem like you have with proprietary companies, where an agency comes in and says, hey, you're going to have to insert this code because we say you have to, and you're not allowed to tell anyone. That's not possible in an open source project because there's no closed way to insert new code. Everybody gets to see all of the code. So I respect David and his team very much. They've done an enormous amount of work, like you said, the last 6-7 years to build distributed systems. And I think if you really want that, then get in there, look at the code. If you're a developer, contribute and make it happen.
Okay, when we come back, you know, David Johnston, you know, is, I mean, one of the guys, you got the money, you're kind of distributing, you're going around and saying, hey, you know, we got some cash for you to develop, and we see the market of it, kind of, yeah, that's the guy you ask. That's the guy you talk, because you know what? There's enormous, there's like shitloads of money available for people who can do this. Ooh, did I say the S word on radio? Freaking A! I am so sick of this crap. You know, I'm amped up now, man, because it wasn't so much, I anticipated that they'd do something like this. My problem, and I've been screaming, and everywhere you see me go, where are we seeing each other? We see each other at Texas Bitcoin, Pork New York Fest. Bitcoin, and Pork Fest. And every time my mantra, fist pounding, has been exactly the same. What the hell are you doing messing, giving a crap what these guys say? The fact that you even do that is just you're bending over and, you know, and saying do me. I'm like, what? Who are these people that are still on board with, you know, working with the government, and I got my compliance officer? What separates them from the people that they use to market this? Because I believe the anarchist libertarian portion of this whole entire movement was used to propagate and promote, you know, what was going to get screwed in the end anyway.
I don't know. I think everybody's fighting the good fight. You know, I mean, I come from the Ron Paul background, and I've been a libertarian since 2001. And so I don't think it's a static thing. I think we're all working to get this as distributed as possible.
Not all. I mean, who's the other guys on the other side?
Well, all the guys that want to work with the government or do this. I mean, it was really sad to see the Winklevoss, you know, come out and congratulate, you know, Ben when he proposed his regulations, because, you know, it's clearly not in line with any of the ideals of the community. So, you know.
Well, how's the core team? See, this is the one thing that I didn't understand early on. I start to find out more. It comes down to two things. Right. It comes down, can they, yes or no, change the code? Well, yeah, but it'd be almost impossible. They can't. They got to get all the miners and all that. Kind of all the miners. What do you mean? Oh, 50 plus 1% of they approved. Whoa, wait a minute. Wait. You mean it's all about processing power? If somebody's got the big giant computer, they probably mean like government? You mean like that? And then they pass a law and they say, you know what? You have black and you have white Bitcoin, and this one's not approved and whatever, and these are the only ones that get approved, and they go, and there's a fork. Okay, here it is. We approve these and not these. Well, then that means dark coins got to go on to another whatever chain of they kind of. Are you kidding me? And I got to talk to people, you know, development, and they go, well, no, they. What do you mean they can't? They're doing it. When they pass some kind, I guarantee this is what it's going to have. They want the kitchen sink. They threw the entire everything at you, and they go, well, they'll, okay, we bitched, and they took out this thing, and they took out that thing. Let me tell you the one thing they're not going to take out. The one thing they always wanted, traceability. They're going to want to have Bitcoin will be assigned to individuals. I guarantee that is not negotiable. And if they don't get it in the first round, they'll get it in the second, third someday. Because that's what they all, it's this cashless society thing they're threatening my generation with for freaking ever. You know, I'm going, this has every bit of the core of them to be able to do that. Am I wrong?
Yes.
Okay, you can explain that to me when we come back. Here we go.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, I you don't believe.
keep telling me, nope, it's okay, it's fine, fine. You know, it's the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over and over. You know, all I got to do is, if I, you know, wanted to be like clairvoyant and the guy and I know everything, is I can just predict government's bad. Freedom good. Government bad. But in the end, freedom always wins. It just gets messy first. And the thing that I want, you know, David Johnson from bitangels.co is going to help me out with, you know, my generation, and I guess ones before, they're screaming about a cashless society. They wanted to be able to track everything that you're doing. They, them, those won't leave us alone. Who are they? They're the ones that won't leave me alone. They're guys with, you know, force and threat of force, and they, what, I don't care. You know, Klingons, congressmen, we're all same thing, all right? So the thing is they go, you know, what we want to do is be able to tax everything that you do. We want to be able to, everything, every latte you buy, every babysitter you pay, everything, unless you're dealing like silver, which is going to make a big giant silver calculator app. Go get it on the Play Store and you'll start to see why. But the thing is I'm going, this society that they want to be able to track everything, that's what this bit license thing is about. You have to have a know your customer policy to interface with the banking system of whatever. Well, what does that do? Then you got the dark wallet. You know, Cody Wilson's on for 2 hours Friday talking about him and Amir Taki doing their thing. What is it? You have now what's going to be black Bitcoin, white Bitcoin. Well, is it approved on the same blockchain? You know, is there going to be a policy, 50 plus 1% of the miners kind of, and we're with the government over here and we decide and it's not approved unless? Or are they going to have both? I don't know. I am asking David that very question. David, help me out. Help me understand this. Can they, well, I know they'll pass a law and they say you got it, but is there the possibility that they'll go, these are legal and these are illegal Bitcoin and they have any impact on the market?
That's great. So let's go back to our analogy of Napster, right? They could pass a law and say peer-to-peer file sharing is bad, and Napster has to shut down.
Yeah, they arrested soccer moms. I got story after story of their poster children of look what we can do, and that has an effect.
Right. It has an effect, but it didn't stop thousands of alternative versions of Napster from popping up that were more and more decentralized. Until we got something like BitTorrent, which is sort of fully decentralized.
Which is naval intelligence software.
Yeah. So what I'm saying about Bitcoin is the same thing. They could pass a law tomorrow that says Bitcoin is bad, and if you run a central company, it's shut down. But all that's going to do is you're going to have 1,000 versions of Bitcoin that are more difficult to track, more anonymous, more decentralized in the way that they operate. And really, Bitcoin is already that thing. You know, people tried electronic money before Bitcoin. They tried e-gold. They tried e-cash. All these systems had the same problem. They were centralized, right? And Bitcoin is already that response to a decade of the government trying to regulate and overburden centralized electronic cash systems. So already, with Bitcoin, nobody can force me to update my software. You mentioned earlier, well, what if they took control of the majority of the hashing power. Even if they were to do that, I've still got my version of Bitcoin, which hasn't been corrupted, downloaded on my computer. And if they try to change something, I can just go with all the people that don't want to do that change, and we'll have a fork, and we'll have our own Bitcoin version that doesn't have the crazy changes. Right? So that ultimately, the power is in the individual hands of everybody that has a copy of the software.
Okay, Donna, this is what I want you to do. In the second hour, put up the link of embed the video of South Park Human Centipad, okay? Where you agree? I totally agreed. Because this is what's going to happen. I already see it. They go, well, do you agree to have your operating system of this phone? Do you agree? You want to use it? You agree? I see this happening. I already know the social and economic and societal engineering of whatever, and do you agree? And the thing is that now we're going to have to talk to Andreas about, you know, how this Apple phone all of a sudden put the blockchain.info back on. I want to know where that came from. But the thing is I'm going, look, you say, oh, well, I'll just this and I just that. every time you say justice, 47 keystrokes that grandma doesn't know about. And you keep talking about all the community, wide adoption. Let me tell you what, it's got to be grandma, and it's got to be one chain. It's got to be one or something easy to eye on it. And it's not there. And I'm wondering where it's coming from. You're the bit angel guys. I mean, you're investing in development of whatever. Who's the teams, or are there teams that are out there again? You know what? We need a new kind of wallet to bite me. You know, is that going on right now? Make me feel better. Come on.
Sure. There are a lot of great projects that are basically trying to implement in a really easy way. You just push the button and you've anonymized everything in your wallet. So one of the leaders in there is actually blockchain, and I hope you talk to Andreas about this, is they've done a lot of good work around making it easy for people to increase the privacy of Bitcoin with mixing coins and other things like that. So there's a lot of good proposals and projects that are coming out. It'll take time. It's like the internet in 1994. It's still geeky. It's still a little hard to use, but people are building on the layers. But you're sending the right message. You want people, if they're because they've got a choice when they build something. They can build it in a way that doesn't have privacy built in, or they can build it in a way where they do have privacy built in. And so all of the projects that I'm involved in are open source. I don't fund any projects that aren't open source. I don't fund any projects that aren't decentralized. I don't fund any projects that haven't removed all the bottlenecks in their system. You know, that's my big focus this year, is centralized applications. That's the only thing that I'm working on, because I think it avoids all of these issues that we're talking about.
Okay, now let me go ahead and give you my perspective on something. I want to, you know, give me your opinion. When I was first met you and some of the other guys, and I'm talking to them, and I say, I need, and how come, and why, and everything, you know, I could tell. I'm not, you know, an idiot. I look back, and they're kind of like, who is this guy? You know, screw him. You know, it's, you know, he wants this, and he doesn't understand, he doesn't get it, and, you know, he's one of them. And I'm going, all right. So then they have the awards that you gave, five $250,000 contracts. One of them is promising they're going to make them more anonymous, whatever. I see the same guys at New York Bitcoin Conference. How's that going? Well, we're working on something else. It's not that important. And I'm going, look. This is, are they, at the time, they're probably now not as thinking I'm as crazy, but at the time, I could see it in their eyes. They're like, well, we already got anonymous. We're geeks. It's not our fault you're stupid and you're old. It's not our fault you don't get it. And I'm going, man, that attitude, I go, these young kids lack the experience to understand what the hell is going on. If you do not free yourself from them, they're going to enslave you. And there was no emphasis on this. So I need to understand, is it a front of mind, head of cortex kind of rock and roll going to get it fixed, like, not later? Is this a focus now? What's the other focus? What's the other project they're working on? Help me out, David.
Well, yeah, one of the big projects that we funded out of the Austin Hackathon was Block Off with Adam Brown, because we need a decentralized way to basically give people private ways to log into things and make it easy, like you're describing, for the average person to just push a button. Literally just push a button. Like, they log into Facebook today, instead log in privately, you know, using the latest technology. Because I agree with what you're saying. You know, people take for granted that it's easy to get this anonymity, but it's not. Right, all the Linux guys think it's easy, but the rest of us don't use Linux.
You know, I did my first install of Linux a few weeks ago. It was a five-hour process. I had to have a professional Linux guy, of the son-in-law of a good friend, to get and kind of, I'm going, are you freaking kidding me? This is your just buttons? You know, holy crap. So I'm, you know, it's time. Past time. All right. Well, thanks for helping me out with, you know, this part of it. In the last segment here, you know, let's pimp some Bit Angel for your kindness of coming on and let me yell. But, you know, is there a specific project that you want to pimp, or something you want to do or keep secret, or what?
Well, we've got a couple of projects that are just coming up. They'll probably talk about storage. I'm a big fan of what they're doing with the decentralized storage on top of MadeSafe. And so probably talk about what they're doing.
Okay, now the one thing I saw, what is it? CoinJoin, Coinbase, one of them, they're doing their story. Which one is that? Coin something. Anyway, one of these guys, yeah. You know, I went on because I originally, matter of fact, I needed some Bitcoin to pay David for my cut into whatever. So I didn't have enough Bitcoin. So I go, you know, I needed to get some. I finally bought them from a friend. But, you know, I'm going into their system. Of course, they wanted a DNA sample. But when in filling it out, I get on their, you know, their blog thing. Okay. So I'm going, okay. So they start sending me stuff. I look at, and they're amping up big time. Ooh, and we're the storage guys. So I look at it just a little bit, and I got the impression they get the private key. I go, what the hell? You're just like a bank. Might as well be Mt. Gox. Yeah, but we got government kind of supervision of we'll be signed some piece of paper or something. You know, what's up with that?
Well, I think they're talking about Coinbase Vault. And so the Vault is their idea of trying to compete with Zappo, which is offering all the safe storage of Bitcoin. But yeah, I never encourage anyone to store their Bitcoin with a central third party, because then you've got a point of failure there. The only redeeming factor is what they're doing involves multi-signature. And that's what we really need, is multi-signature abilities. When you have a group and you want to sign a transaction, you can have multiple people do it. That's really good security. So, but we'll get there. But yeah, I'm talking about decentralized storage of information, the Storage J project. You might have heard about it.
Okay, well, I haven't. I mean, even if I did, you're assuming I know what the hell you're talking about. But, you know, go ahead and...
A replacement for Dropbox.
Oh, that's cool. Encrypted?
Yep. Encrypted on the client side, completely private, and powered by the cloud. No central server.
So this is a MadeSafe thing or something else?
This is a project being built on top of MadeSafe called Storage.
Awesome. Because I can see that was the whole point, you know, of MadeSafe, right, is to allow exactly that. And there's my next. Right. Okay, that's another thing I want about video. And, okay. Now, what we're going to do is when we come back, I want to go right to Coinbase Vault thing, because that is, you know, I can see that is a direct result of, one, market, but also done in such a way that the man is approved of, you're allowed, and you're regulated kind of crap. You know, this is exactly what I see, you know, that it's development is already in money and resources and talent is going to that way, how much, you know, we can go down on Uncle Sam. And I'm going, are you freaking kidding me? You know, so I bet they got locked into that. You know, they once you started dancing with them, you know, I mean, you leave the dance with who brung you. So and they brought them, so they're going to give them their little, you know, whatever sanction or something. So let's go ahead and start there, and that'll get us into the storage on MadeSafe, and then I want to talk about video. I'm going to tell this, give me 2 minutes to tell my video story about, you know, the storage of video and YouTube competition or the whatever, and that'll lead right into this after we get on the Coinbase Vault thing. So we'll do Coinbase Vault, then I'll talk about the video storage, and then we'll get into storage on top of MadeSafe, okay?
Sounds good.
All right, here we go.
.cc, as in Creative Commons.
If you enjoy LRN.FM, please contribute to your favorite shows via their websites and become an amplifier at amp.lrn.fm. That's amp.lrn.fm.
Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
So screwy, we're just screaming in the night. Let me out of this cheap B-movie. Headlong down the highway and do rushing headlong out of control. And you think you're so strong, but there ain't no stopping, and you can't stop rocking, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Part of this, nothing you can do about a crowd, because I'm just like, you know, nyar, 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 nyar. This is the one thing that I start to see when I needed some Bitcoin, you know, right away. I had to, you know, do some. I owed David Irvine made safe kind of Bitcoin doing. We're working together on what I'm going to send you some more and kind of let's do it. Well, I need, you know, I had some friends and I finally got some, but I thought, well, I'll go try this thing. You know, Drew from Bitcoin.bomb says, hey, well, you know, you can go to Coinbase, I think it was, and you can go in and buy and get in and just do it. And they wanted the DNA sample. And I go, seriously? You know, I'm going, nah, maybe not. But what happened was I got on their blog thing, or their email announce I get every day or so, and I kind of look at it. All of a sudden, they're pimping their vault thing, and it's called Coinbase Vault or something like that. And I'm going, I got the impression that whatever kind of encryption or multi-signature kind of make it better and somebody can't rip it off kind of deal. But I got the impression that it's some kind of, I got to give them the private key that they have. I got to go, well, hell, I thought we got away from Mt. Gox kind of stuff. Well, David's going to explain it to me. David, help me out, man. What the hell are they offering?
Well, they're pretty much offering a service that's going to store people's Bitcoins for them. They're trying to compete with the big storage company called Zappo that raised $40 million earlier this year to do the same thing. But I encourage folks not to store their Bitcoin with any third party, because like you said, then you create this bottleneck where you've got a trusted third party, and the whole point of Bitcoin is that you can be your own bank. So even if people use Coinbase to buy Bitcoins, I say immediately take them and put them in your own Bitcoin wallet. Hold your own private key, because you're correct. The Coinbase system does not allow you to hold your own private key, so it creates a lot of vulnerability there.
Okay, now that's another thing, is that, you know, yeah, go ahead and do it and just put it on your own private, and if they pass this legislation they proposed out of New York, you're not going to be able to just go buy it and it be anonymous. They don't know who you are and change run it. It's got to be linked to you, true or false.
It depends where you live. So if you're in New York, that's the case. If you're not in New York, then it's not going to extend. A lot of the developers I
this
know
week
are writing patches that are going to block all the guys out of New York because they don't want to have to comply to these ridiculous
regulations. I feel prosecutors and arrest and kind of, and you're not allowed and you touched New York and it went through a bank that had a former roommate's girlfriend that worked as a bank teller in Manhattan. I mean, who are we kidding here?
Right, exactly. It creates a huge risk for the whole ecosystem.
Which was the point.
Yeah, exactly. Which was why we go back to the decentralized system.
Okay, now let's go ahead and let me tell this story and you'll understand. I want to get your response to this. In 2005, we started beta testing of Freedom's Phoenix. Then we had in 2000... Donna, here, phone. In 2006, we kind of launched, we get going, we're soft launch, we're going. Then we had, in the next hour, we have Terry Bressey from Checkpoint USA, wins another case, am I being detained, I'm not playing your game. He does Skywatch, Space Watch, he goes to Kitt Peak Observatory, he works at University of Arizona, he's checking, making sure we're not going to die from an asteroid. But he has to go through all these checkpoints going across to Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation, they stop him, he's like, am I being detained, da 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 da. Now what happened was, he would do all these YouTube videos, YouTube's just getting started, the Union of the Border Patrol kind of, and they're trying to get him fired and all this kind of stuff, and YouTube starts taking it down, said, hell no, get your stuff, we put it on our servers at Freedom's Phoenix, and we just load the video up and you could watch it, didn't have as convenient a player or the bandwidth and everything of YouTube, but I'm going, no, we are not going to allow this kind of censorship. Now, the problem was, is that if I turned Freedom's Phoenix into like a YouTube thing for freedom-oriented kind of, boom, damn, I better be getting me some servers. Now, what happens is, there's an expense to that and so on, and then there's advertising, I mean, you got to have a bunch of money invested in it, can we do that? Well, I'm waiting. I'm going, you know, there's going to come a time. Made Safe is the time, because Made Safe allows for the distribution and storage of data all over. That's the whole point of this. Now, my question to David is this. I put on Made Safe. I get this app. I do. Can I take all my shows that I do on video, and I don't do YouTube because I use some classic rock and roll and kind of, and you're not allowed, and I go, bite me. I go to Blip. They do the same. Bite me. I go to Vimeo. I have all the files sitting here ready to upload onto my own servers or to the Made Safe cloud. That ability to everybody and their grandma can create their own YouTube, not even channel, I mean the whole entire structure can be built on top of Made Safe and distributed all over an entire planet, and they can suck it. True or false?
True. And so one of the projects that's making this easy is a project called Storage. It's spelled storj.io, and this is one of the first applications built on top of MadeSafe that's like a decentralized or distributed Dropbox. So instead of storing your files on a central Dropbox server, like you're saying, it gets distributed all among the cloud, all over the world. It's encrypted from the user's side, and the user doesn't have to know anything technical or do anything technical. They can use the program directly to store all of their files, just upload them, drag and drop like you would with Dropbox.
And you have some kind of player, and you click on a video, and boom, it plays.
Yep.
This is so you're not allowed. This is disruptive of every single freaking little whatever disturbance in the Saudi. We got right now the NSA working with Saudi Arabia to go after dissenters there. You provide this service. You got the, you know, you got Turkey flipping off, you know, and Twitter's off now. You know, you do this. This is what this is earth shattering, changing. Do they understand the ramifications of this?
Yeah, I think people involved really get the scale of what they're doing, but there's no way to stop the technology, and the genie's out of the bottle. If it's not this project, it'll be 10 others that get built in the next few months. So it'll be exciting to see how it develops, but I want people to get involved and really push these decentralized technologies.
Okay, Ada, you know, I mean, you don't have to answer this, but did you invest and got some goodies and gave some Bitcoin and got your share of your... Yeah, you were doing the MasterCoin thing. You're pimping that. You know, and it jumped up to 100 from zero and down to 10. Everybody goes, oh, it's pump and dump. I go, well, it's 10. I mean, it was better than nothing, you know. So it goes up. It does that. Are you in the line to do the same thing with MadeSafe and SafeCoin and kind of we're going to all be gazillionaires? What up?
Sure. Well, the Decentralized Applications Fund is all an open book. You can go to our website at dapsfund.com and see all of the projects that we're working with.
Okay, what fund? What did you call it?
DAPS Fund, D-A-P-P-S. DAPSfund.com is for the Decentralized Applications Fund. And yeah, the crowd sale for MadeSafe is going on right now. And so people that want to support them can send in support. We're participating in that. We released an informational report to anybody that wants to read it about the project, and that's sort of what we do.
Okay, I'm David. I appreciate you coming on and being a good friend of the show. It's really nice of you to keep us informed and work, even though I'm, you know, yelling half the time. But I'm telling you, I'm so frustrated that this wasn't so much better understood by those that were doing the foundation thing and working with them. I'm going, what the hell did you think was going on? This entire thing is not to be working with them an alternative or make it better or I'm the new PayPal. It was to be outside of it. Because when eBay and PayPal was going and you had all of a sudden enormous amount of effort went in to create your own businesses and off the grid, and they went, oh, and you're back on the grid. And I'm going, you know, seriously, how are we going to be able to get, here comes, you know, the distributed internet, which I thought was going to develop as a young activist in the early 90s anyway. So I'm going, okay, this is what I need you to help, you know, us understand what's coming, the social and economic ramifications of this, and to keep us on the edge of what apps we need to be paying attention to and downloading and being part of. Because to make MadeSafe work, you know, it's going to, and it doesn't even need to be Americans. It's going to be developing of around the planet of Bite Me, and they just upload the system, and they need to. If you're in any other country that is more oppressive than U.S., if you can find one, you know, they're going to want to do this. This is going to explode on the planet. What's your feeling? Is this going? Is it going to go in China? Is it going to go in India? Is it going?
There's no way to stop it, and we're moving to a borderless world. That's where we're going.
Borderless. Hey, David Johnston, bitangels.co. It's .co, right?
Yep.
Okay. Any other thing, a website or project you want to pimp real quick in the next 30 seconds?
Just the DAPS Fund. Follow all the decentralized technologies we're working on and help out.
DAPS Fund. D-A-P-P-S Fund. Just put it in your browser and search. I don't even say Google search anymore. Screw them. You know, do like any freaking thing else. I am so sick of this. David Johnston, thanks for keeping us up, man. Hold on a second. I want to talk to you. This is what's in the next hour. Next hour, Terry Bressy, Checkpoint USA. You know, they can't get you, you know, at the checkpoint. They'll get you online. With that online thing's going away. Now what?
On Free Talk Live.
Very cool. Thank you very much. What I want to go ahead and do, Donna will send this to you, and of course this will hit everybody who want to listen. But keep me up on what's going on. David's going to come on. I told him I wouldn't even bother him until, you know, like the end of the first week in August. I got other stuff to do, and my 30th wedding anniversary is coming up. I have all kinds of crap. But the thing is, he's going to be at a point to where finally he's going to be able to, you know, take a breath, and we're going to get to talk about it. And this storage thing is, you know, I'm hip to that. But that, is it that easy? I can, you know, download the software, and I can just start uploading. There's really no limit to how much I can upload, right?
just drag and drop. You can go to the website right now and check it out, storj.io.
400 gig. I got 400 gig of whatever the hell I put it up. Can I do that?
Well, go ahead and test their system. We can find out.
Oh, I'm going to freaking test, you damn Skippy. Yeah. See, this is what's going on. You remember Derek Slopey, you know, the guy with the... Yeah, you know Derek. You know, did you meet him? He was the guy that had the drone and the ambulance at Porkfest and so on. And I think I'm sure he met you and said, yo, what's up? We're making the transfer. Probably this week we'll flip the switch to transfer all of Freedom's Phoenix over to new servers. And the reason that I selected him and his team, there's some other guys working on it, as I told him, I said, look, I need this, the what do you guys call it, APIs of the made to the blah, 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 who cares? That's not my problem. But what happens is, I said, what I need is to make sure that we are ready to take advantage of the MadeSafe system, because I want Freedom's Phoenix mirrored over on that. And we'll be the news and opinion of the blah, 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 and we'll be mirrored over there, and we're here. And then you got Roberts and Roberts and say, you know what? And we're MadeSafe metal brokers that we kind of interface with, and we're over here too. And then other people will start, and we'll start helping lead that. But I need the ability to use the software to upload not just, you know, our information and use their cloud form of whatever to have Freedom's Phoenix up there, but I want to upload a shitload of the MP3s of the, I got it's like 300 gig worth of stuff, you know, and that doesn't include the video. So when we do the video with that, it could be, you know, God knows that. We're going to find out. I can guarantee I'll be like the number one unless there's somebody else got more. So I'm like, here we go.
Well, it's going to have plenty of space on it. I want to be one of the first nodes in Austin, so I went to Best Buy, grabbed four hard drives with 3 terabytes each. So I expect there'll be a ton of people all over the world adding space to it. So
okay, now that is one other thing that I need to know. I did get another terabyte here, and then I have my other servers, you know, that'll run the site, and I got. And David's going to help us set it up, and we can do the farming thing. But I need someone, and... How long are we from flipping the switch that we start the farming? A month, two, end of the year? What are we talking about?
They're in the first test net. I think they want to get through their first two test nets and then their third test net before they launch the main one. You'd have to ask David. I know he's been shooting for September, October for the main net, but it'll depend on how fast it goes on the test nets.
Okay, now, do I need to have a dedicated CPU to doing this? Do I got to have bigger bandwidth? Because I have my network, I can download at about 85 megabytes, upload about 20. So I got a pretty good connection, you know, if we're doing all my stuff. So this is perfect for me. So I'm going, all right, so let's go ahead and set it up. I mean, do I got to have a dedicated computer, or I just, because I got like within 10 feet of me, I got like, you know, 15 gazillion computers. I got like 8 computers in front of me. So I can net them all into it? Or should I dedicate it to one with a bunch of hard drive or what?
I'd probably do one with a bunch of hard drives, but it's a good question for David. It's definitely the kind of thing you want to have running 24/7, because the network gives each node a rating and tells you how good that node is, and it gives it more and more storage as it knows it has a good node.
All right, man, I'm all over it. I'm going to be counting on you guys to help me out with the list of I got to get. You know, that's one thing I told David, that's the big deal for Tim Fry and I. He's going to help us out and get started with this and be part of the node. But it's so being a user and a node, are those two different things?
Yes, but, you know, being a node will make it easy to be the user. So especially since you'll be generating all those safe coins and then using them yourself, it's a good way to go.
Yeah, no, that's a, you know, because I want, because if I load it up, all the stuff that I'm talking about onto my own thing here, well, hell, then it just propagates throughout the planet and I'm done.
Right.
Sweet.
Got it.
Can I be part of, so their first net test, is that open or is that an internal thing?
It's something you download and you run on a region by region basis. The next ones will be more open and global. You can actually look at the visualizer. I think there's a web link on their website, or you can get it from David, that shows all of the nodes up and running and taking in data and releasing data and things like that.
Okay, well, I need to get kind of a head start. I'm going to be a slow learner on this, and then I can probably bring in some of the geeks to do this. But I want to be there, and freaking the beachhead of the Omaha Beach and invading. Here we go. I think I need to be, because, you know, being the Lovolution guy and kind of, you know, having the multimedia network that I got, this is a perfect, because I don't want it to be in secret, because the man will do some stupid thing if they already got a plan of something I already know. I mean, I don't know what it is, but they got some, they don't like it. Okay, so I'm going, you all right? Yeah, well, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us, and I'm part of the all, and let's go kick ass. So keep me informed, all right. Please.
All right, brother, we'll do.
All right, thanks, David. You've been a good sport. I appreciate it.
All right, talk to you soon.
All right, peace. Bye.
It's the Onion Radio News. Starbucks begins its sinister phase two of operation. This is Doyle Redland reporting. After a decade of aggressive expansion throughout North America and abroad, Starbucks suddenly and unexpectedly closed its 56,423 worldwide locations today to prepare for what insiders call phase two of the company's long-range plan. Cynthia Valcamp, Starbucks head of marketing, made this brief statement at a press conference earlier today.
We've enjoyed furnishing you with coffee-related beverages and are excited about the important role you play in our future plans.
Existing Starbucks franchises across the nation have been shuttered with high-strength titanium, and the well-known Starbucks logo has been slightly altered to present the familiar mermaid figure as a cyclopean mermaid whose all-seeing eye forms the apex of a world-spanning pyramid. Doyle Redland for the Onion Radio News, online at theonion.com.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Today, let us make them remember. We are not afraid.
No fear! No fear, no fear, no fear. Let me tell you, unafeared individual, then he proved himself over and over and over and over and over and over, even before doing the checkpoint over and over. Mr. Bresse. Okay, let me go ahead and give you the little bio on him while we run some graphics up here. Terry Bresse is a staff engineer at the University of Arizona's Planetary Lab. To get to Kitt Peak National Observatory, so he can save us from the high impact of asteroid we don't die-ism. Okay, so I said just leave Terry alone. Hippus, you know what the planet Earth did? I mean, I got to share this. L. Neil Smith, a good libertarian science fiction writer, he goes, you know, we could have had advanced civilizations on Earth for all the hell we know. You know, we could have had life in the ancient alien of the whatever the heck, you know, millions of years ago, and we don't know it. It got, bombarded and kind of in the Earth crust, kind of, it's all gone. All right? We don't know. It could be us that was the alien of whatever the hell. You know, what happens? An asteroid hits and it'd start over time. Okay? So what did the Earth do? As time went on, eventually, we have the Earth, the planet itself, has created us as the antibody against, like, space debris. So, think about it. So, who is the head antibody, the white blood cell? Go out and get Mr. Terry Bresse. You know, if that's not enough pressure. Okay, so Terry Bresse is up there at the Kitt Peak National Observatory, where he must take an east-to-west running highway, which has an in-country immigration checkpoint on, the Indian reservation was a whole nother issue on that, too. That was interesting. We'll talk about that. Bresse estimates he's been stopped over 300 times at immigration checkpoints along this road, which at no point crosses the border. And it's, I mean, you know, a long ways from the border, too. I mean, you know, it's not like 10 miles. It's like, you know, more, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 miles. It's a ways, okay? Terry runs the website checkpointusa.org, dedicated to confronting those who would place roadblocks in the path of free individuals and to exposing the police state one checkpoint at a time. Here it comes. We knew it. It was December of 02. I mean, this is just over a year after 9-11, and Mr. Libertarian Terry Bresset could see what was up. And he goes, oh, no. One of the first guests I had on my show, good libertarian friend from Tucson in 03, I had my guy tell me everything. Mr. Terry Bresset keeps whipping ass, and he got one more ass whipping that he's got to add, but they keep trying. Terry, welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Now, this latest, let's talk about your experience with the man to begin with. You know, how did this start? Give me, in the rest of this segment, you got like 5 minutes. Give me your five-minute spiel, and then we'll get into all the update, and I'm going to tell you some good news about how we're going to help you in additional ways that you may not know. Okay, so go ahead and give us the history. Go.
Okay, sure thing. Yeah, you know, I was this started way back in December of 2002. I'm coming home from a working at the Kitt Peak National Observatory, and I get stopped by the tribal police along State Route 86. And it wasn't just the tribal police; it was also U.S. Customs and the United States Border Patrol. They had a very large presence at what was allegedly a sobriety checkpoint that was set up by the tribal police. So, you know, me being me, I asked a couple of questions. Once I get stopped at the checkpoint, the tribal police didn't like my answers. They allowed a customs agent to come up and harass me. I asked why the customs agent was even talking to me if this was a sobriety checkpoint. Once again, they didn't like my questions or my answers, and before I knew it, I was being dragged out of my vehicle, handcuffed, and dragged off to the side of the road and being charged with two criminal misdemeanors. And I fought those charges in court with the help of Mark Victor. I had them dismissed. It took about a year, and then I turned around and filed a lawsuit against the tribal police. And that suit took about 10 years to settle. It finally settled in 2012.
And you got like hundreds of thousands of dollars, went to the Ninth Circuit, and then you go, na 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 na. But, you know, the thing is that it didn't stop, though. And they get,
oh, no.
Are these new people? Do they get a new, I mean, don't they have, like, don't freaking hassle Terry? I mean, did they get a new guy, or are they just, you know, testing out new techniques? I mean, I don't understand what they're thinking.
You know, I think that, in fact, I've been told that they use my videos as training videos in the Border Patrol there. And a lot of the agents know better, and they just wave me through before I can even stop at the checkpoint. But there's always that minority of agents that are just too authoritarian and just
to let you get away with it. They go,
exactly.
But so they do know who you are. They just want to test their mettle.
Oh, yeah. In fact, the agent who stopped me at this most recent encounter back in April 30th there, he actually called me out by name. I have it on video. So, you know, right there, he showed that he had absolutely no basis to detain me because he already knew who I was. And the whole purpose of these checkpoints is supposed to be for immigration purposes.
Well, what are they, bored? I mean, they just, you know, respect my authority. You caused them a minute's sleep because you're just out there being free and stuff. I mean, what's their mindset? Somebody told them to do it? I mean, what?
No, you know, these agents, they have a lot of latitude and individual discretion on the field. And when you get a hot-headed person who's attracted to the authority and the power that goes along with a gun and a badge, they will abuse that authority and power regardless of what constraints, you know, may be put on their actions by the courts or even their own agency. You know, they just can't help themselves. It's human nature.
But what did they think? I don't understand. See, I got to get back to the psychology of this. What did they think was going to happen? All of a sudden, Terry's going to go, oh, okay. I mean, I don't understand what they were thinking was going to happen.
Well, this particular agent, and hopefully I can get into this in some detail here, I figured out what his name was. I asked his name while he was there, and his name tag was covered up mostly by a tactical vest. So his last name was fully concealed, and I was only able to make out his first initial after I went back through my video and enhanced the frames there. But I asked his name. I couldn't hear it at the time because he kind of mumbled it, but I did pull it out in video later. His last name was Tackett. T-A-C-K-E-T-T, and his first initial was J. Well, if you do a search online for a J. Tackett in the Border Patrol, you will find that there was an agent 2 years ago in San Diego who shot and killed a 32-year-old mother of three or four, claiming that she tried to run him over while they were doing some sort of drug sting at some apartment complex.
Son of a
and
bitch.
And eyewitnesses said that, no, she did not try to run them over. She was trying to get away from them. She was backing up her vehicle. He ran down the vehicle, jumped on her hood, and shot 10 times into the vehicle.
You know, I remember that story.
Oh, yeah.
That's the same guy?
I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure because I tried to get video of this agent from back, you know, in San Diego, so I can't match up the pictures, but the name is the same. The age is roughly the same, and he was a white guy, and this is a white guy, too.
Okay, so he gets, that's it, you don't need to work here anymore, I can always get a job being a bad at Border Patrol. Let me show you how it's done. Where's this Terry guy? I'll show you what's up. Let's go get some Terry.
Right, exactly. In fact, he said to me, I was asking him some questions at the checkpoint. He said, you don't ask the questions, I'm going to ask the questions.
No, I always hear that. That's standard SOP
right
there, man.
Mm-hmm. And as soon as I said, well, geez, that's funny, because I just asked you some questions. He got pissed, he turned around, he picked up a spike strip, and he threw it down in front of my vehicle. So this is the mentality of the people that hired him.
Oh, we're going to have a good show, you know, the rest of the hour of the day. Oh, hell yeah. They messing with the wrong guy. But, you know, sooner or later, you know, stuff gets, hopefully he's making these trips during the daytime, because I mean, damn. Yeah, you're usually doing this during the day, right? Yep, I think so. I just turned him off. We'll be right back with Terry Bressy. CheckpointUSA.org. Okay, Terry, when we come back, this is what I want to do. I'm going to go ahead and just ask some questions. One, are these daytime? Have you ever done a nighttime thing, or you just kind of make sure it's during the day?
I have to go through it at night periodically, so maybe a couple times a year.
You know, then the other thing is have you seen this officer, you know, since the court thing? What's been there, you know, kind of like, we need to give you a special sticker or something, leave him freaking alone. Did he get slapped down? What, and what's the order, and did it specify, you know, Border Patrol or this actual agent? Is there a civil suit, you know, ready to come later? And then the fact that they ran you down later, they let you go, and then we're going to get him down the highway kind of crap, okay?
Right.
So let's go. That's what we're going to come back with, all right?
Sure.
All right, 2 minutes.
You can put the Liberty Radio Network on the air in your area. Visit broadcast.lrn.fm to learn how. Broadcast.lrn.fm.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800. 602-264-2800. And now, Ernest Hancock.
Leaves are falling. Titanium testicled, the Terry Bressy. You know, I don't know how else to put it. You know, do they hang low? They swing to and fro? Can you throw them over your shoulder like a Continental Soldier? I mean, here's Terry Bressy, the man. I've known for over a decade doing this. 300 times going through this. And then they bring in a new, you know, mama killer and say, hello. Well, I can't confirm that, but it wouldn't shock me. Okay. So what we're going to go ahead and do is I want to have an understanding of a couple of questions. I got like 4 or 5 questions here, and I want to get this through real quick. One, how many times have you gone at night? I mean, it's kind of part of your day job you got to go through there. So how many times at night? And I mean, I'm thinking that you work at the observatory probably not during the day all the time, right? I mean, you're going there in the afternoon, you're leaving in the morning. I mean, what's your schedule on this?
Well, you know, I serve kind of double duty, so I'm both the chief engineer for the group, and I'm also an observer. So I'm observing up at the Kitt Peak National Observatory probably about 8 nights on average per month.
So that means, you know, I'm traveling up there at night sometimes and coming back too. And sometimes there's equipment breakdowns when I'm not observing. I get a call, so I have to go up, you know, in the middle of the night and try to fix something.
Yeah, I'm not feeling as comfortable at night, you know, them, you know, and hello, Terry, it's dark. I mean, you know, so, I mean, what's the difference of experience you have at night as opposed to the day?
Sure. You know, they have high-intensity lights to light up the entire area at nighttime, so it's lit up pretty well when you're coming through there at night. But you're right. It's a lot more – it feels a lot more intimidating going through the checkpoint at night. And I'll tell you a couple of experiences I've had. You know, probably back in 2009 and 2010, I was pulled over a couple times by roving patrols within the vicinity of the checkpoint. And I think one night, it was about 11 o'clock at night, I drove past the checkpoint, and lo and behold, within a mile or so past the checkpoint, I've got a Border Patrol agent on my tailgate there. He follows me for a mile or so, and then he turns on his lights and pulls me over, right? So, of course, I have my cameras ready to go and get the cell phone up and ready there. And this is the middle of the desert, you know, out in SR, you know, State Route 86, you know, past Three Points, Arizona. There's nothing out there. You're in the middle of nowhere, and you got this gun-toting agent who's pulled you over for no good reason. And
in February, I was going to Texas Bitcoin Conference in Austin, and they had, for some reason, there was a detour south of Tucson for like 50 miles. They just, I guess there's a section of something, I don't know, and they just detour, and everybody had to go off in the middle of the desert out in the nothing, and I went through two checkpoints. And it was scary. I turned on my, you know, quick thing back when that still worked or whatever it was I had on my smartphone. And I go ahead and I do that. I heard tell that they don't have that anymore. All of a sudden, I get a call from Pete Ayer at Cop Block, say, hey, you okay? I'm like, how the hell did you even know? Well, I was, you know, subscribed to your, well, I'm like, thank God, you know? Thank
yeah.
you.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this, yeah. let's go ahead and talk about, did you have a bad experience at night and they pulled you over and stopped? Or they just, like, you know, wanted to explain it to you or what?
Well, you know, the agent comes up to me, right, and I roll down my window maybe an inch or so, and I demand right away, I've got the camera up, and I say, you know, I want to know exactly why you stopped me. What's your lawful purpose for stopping me? He took one look at me and my camera, and he turned around, and he walked back to his patrol vehicle and drove away. So that tells you right there, they can only pull you over for reasonable suspicion.
No, they pull you over because they can. He just didn't, you know, right. He didn't feel comfortable keeping engaging with you. That's for what happened.
Well, right, and that tells you right there that he didn't have, I should say, they can only lawfully pull you over for reasonable suspicion.
Okay, now did you record and put that up on your site? Yep, and they walked off.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
Of
yep,
course
yeah.
you do. Okay, now the yep. next question is that since this last time, they did this similar thing, and we'll get into the details of that real quick, but have you seen this officer since the court decision?
I have not seen him again since the April 30th incident.
Yeah, boy needs to go somewhere else. Okay, and the order was what by the court?
Well, the court basically just dismissed the charges against me.
Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about what happened. You're there, you're stopped, and you know, Mr. Officer Tack, whatever his name is, he wants to explain it to Terry. You guys don't know what you're doing. I'm going to show you how to do it, and I'm doing it. And and you're just going, no, I ain't playing. And he threw stop sticks in front of you. Tell us about that.
Sure. You know, so as you know, I've been following this other thing that's been arising with these checkpoints is that the Border Patrol has been paying local law enforcement to assist Border Patrol agents working in the field. And for the area that I'm in, the Pima County Sheriff's Department has its hand out to the tune of about $1 million annually, money which goes to pay deputies overtime to deploy on behalf of the Border Patrol.
So they're not even on duty in their regular time? This is like a private farm-out thing?
As far as I can tell, they're basically using county resources and getting paid time and a half from federal grants to aid and abet the Border Patrol in the field.
Okay, and now this is called, there's an operation something. What's that called?
It's called, the grant program is called Operation Stone Garden.
So that's a Department of We Rule You SS kind of weird crap.
Okay. Right. So the way that it works is that the Arizona Department of Homeland Security basically works hand in hand with the federal Department of Homeland Security. So the grant money flows from the federal Homeland Security to the Arizona Department of Homeland Security. And then the Arizona Department of Homeland Security then redistributes the grant money out to various local law enforcement agencies that are willing to work on behalf of the Border Patrol in the field.
Aren't you the one that broke this story?
Yes.
You know, they don't like you, man.
No, they don't like me.
You know, they're just going to be, someday it's going to be, they don't like you, okay? So they threw, you go, I ain't playing, and he goes, oh, yeah? Well, then he's like, because he doesn't know any better, he didn't know who he was dealing with, he didn't read the memo, and he throws these stop sticks in front of your car. What do they look like? It's rolled out spikes or something? How's that work?
You know, I tried to get a good view so I could put a picture on my website with regards to the spike strip, but a lot of it was, most of it was covered by his body. He turned his back to me. He pulled the spike strip out of some container that he had behind him, and I only saw a very small portion of it, so I can't give you a very good description.
Okay,
of,
so it would
it
make
like.
Your tires go flat if you drove over.
Yes, right.
Okay,
So
he throws that out, then what?
Well, so then he just stands there with a smirk on his face, right? So I look to the right of me, and I see that his supervisor is sitting off to the side underneath the canopy. So I beat the horn twice to get the supervisor's attention.
All right, now, mimic it. It was like, or was it beep, beep? I mean, tell me what you did.
It was maybe for a count of a second, second and a half, two beeps, okay, for a second, second
so
and
like,
a half.
Something like that,
yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
All right,
exactly.
Done. All right. Now then.
So the supervisor stands up, you know, and he starts to walk over in my direction. And as he's walking over to me,
we're going to break, Orange. You're on the edge of your seat. That was perfect. Okay, we'll be back, and we'll get the rest of the story. He goes, beep, beep. Hey, supervisor, you know it's Terry. This guy's being a butthead. Oh, shoot. Let's go over. All right, man. They come. Oh, we come back here on Declare Your Independence with Mr. Terry Bressett from CheckpointUSA.org. We'll be right back. Okay, that's a perfect place. Okay, so when we come back, we'll start right there. You beeped and they come, and then we'll go from there, okay?
Sure.
All right, and then because this is when was the date on this?
This was on April 30th.
Okay.
So I didn't go to court earlier on this because I had a longstanding planned family vacation, so I put in for several continuances so I could get past the time frame that I was going to be on the road with my family there.
Yeah, I mean, I know you. This is like entertainment, you know.
I've had to adopt your philosophy. If you're not having fun, then you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, hey, man,
otherwise,
bro.
I drive myself crazy, you know.
Okay, this is one thing I want to tell you real quick while we got the time here. Are you ever heard of Made Safe?
No.
Okay. Are you at a computer?
Yes.
Okay. Put MAIDSAFE.net. Tell me if it comes up.
MAIDSAFE.net.
Okay, I'll give you the Evan Wood version on this. What happened is distributed internet software that goes across the planet before the end of the year. I've been following this, doing it, work with them, go to New York, meet the guys, kind of blah, blah, blah. It is the answer, in my opinion, to everything. It's a distributed internet that cannot be shut down. We are setting up, there's a thing called storage you may have heard about, storj.com. Whatever the hell it is, CO or something. And the point is that you have a distributed internet with pieces of your hard drive is the internet. It's like the old BBS system, but it's online with a long story. They did a fundraising thing in April that we helped promote and did our thing. They raised over $7 million in 5 hours. And this is out of Troon, Scotland. A guy, it's long story. Did the page come up?
Yes.
Okay, now you scroll down, you'll see a video there. Watch that video after the show or something. You can watch that, and you'll go, oh. And who was I thinking of? You. And we were talking about you in the last hour we did the show. And the point is that remember when they were trying to take off all your YouTubes and had to take down all that kind of stuff, and we put them up on Freedom's Phoenix? Well, this allows us to do that. You can do that. It's on real cloud, not this cloud technology on CIA servers at Amazon kind of bullshit. No, this is actual real across the planet thing, to where you put this stuff up and they can't stop it. This is so disruptive. This is though they are so hell no, so not allowed. And when we put all our videos, we start loading that up. I'd love to take your files and teach you and have you get and do it. Plus, it, the ability by having it, you get, you earn kind of crypto coin kind of, but it's not based on just make work. I wasted my time in electron Bitcoin crap. It's like, they call it farming. It's actually how much data you store and share and all that. And it's like Napster, you get paid kind of thing. But watch this, and I so neon flash an obvious thought of you and what you're doing, because it's all this dissent from around the planet. They can't stop sharing of the information, which is exactly what they tried to do to you, and I'm glad we were there to help, but I'm telling you, it's going to get worse, and this makes it better.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, please, and this is something that you would understand the ramifications of probably more than most. All right, here we come.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
It's more than a feeling. It's done. You're all right. It's done. We got some actual factual information. During the break, I was telling Terry about the MadeSafe thing. I mean, I know a lot of the audience knows this. MadeSafe.net. This allows for the storage and distribution, and they can't take it downism of the videos of Bite Me, because they tried to stop Terry doing this. You know, the Border Patrol Union, whatever the hell that was, trying to get him fired from University of Arizona. And Terry's out there saving the freaking world from, I don't get hit with an asteroid I didn't know and didn't send Armageddon shuttled SpaceX go kick its ass, you know, because I'm like, damn it. You know, this is so important, what's going on here, because it doesn't matter, you know, if you save the Earth, if you're a freaking slave all the time anyway. So what happened is Terry was able to take these videos and make sure people understood what was going on, and it's evidence. So what happens is they wanted them taken down. They, them, those, who the hell they were. Tell us about that, Terry. Who the hell were they? This border thing of what entity was that trying to do this under what name?
The Border Patrol has a national union where non-officer Border Patrol agents basically unionize and, you know, and represent members for what are supposed to be internal issues with regards to, you know, pay and schedules and things like that. But the local union here was pretty outspoken. In fact, I think it's, if you go to local 2544.org or .net is the local Border Patrol Union's web page. I'm not sure on that address.
And you're a star. You're a star. You got they got your picture somewhere. There's little memos going on about you. Anyway, they went after you and kind of, and Freedom's Phoenix, we would take those videos and I said, you know, screw them, and we put them on. I go, try and freaking take, try and take it down for me. Let's go and kick ass, because we got Michael Kilsky, state chair of the Libertarian Party, is an attorney and our security guy for Freedom's Phoenix. I'm like, please, let's play. They didn't want to play. Okay, so now you get those back up, but here comes Made Safe. There's nothing they can do to stop it, distributed, and we're glad to introduce you to that. Go take a look at it. Now, they stopped you. They put the power strips up there. You beep your horn. Beep, beep. The supervisor goes, all right, it's Terry. Damn it. What did he say to him? Did he have an exasperated, oh, my God, here we go again look on his face or not?
You know, I think he did. He knew what the score was pretty quick. But nonetheless, he had to back up his agent. You know, his agent had made a decision to detain me in the lane of traffic, and he couldn't let his agent lose face. So the supervisor comes over to me, and I asked the supervisor, I said, why is your subordinate illegally detaining me here in the lane of traffic? And the supervisor says, well, did you answer his questions? And I said, you know as well as I do that I have no legal obligation to answer his questions, and he can't lawfully continue the detention for me failing to respond to his questions. And he said, well, will you pull over to the side? And I said, I don't think so. He said, well, just stay there. And he walked away from me, picked up his radio, and walked to the back of my vehicle.
So as I had been coming into the checkpoint, I noted that there was a county sheriff deputy whose vehicle was parked at the checkpoint. And I knew right away that the deputy was there under this Operation Stone Garden thing where he's being paid time and a half to help the Border Patrol. But nonetheless...
Help him what?
Oh, with harassing people like me. That's why. Because the bottom line is, like you said, I've been through these checkpoints 300 to 350 times. And not once have I ever answered the Border Patrol's questions. Not once have I ever pulled off to the side of the road when they told me to do so. So that the fact that the Border Patrol has never brought any charges against me should tell you something. That they haven't brought charges against me because they're nice guys. They haven't brought charges against me because they don't have a legal leg to stand on. Okay.
Well, they'll just change the law, but that's coming, okay? So anyway, all the way to the Ninth Circuit and kind of made it, and they go, yeah, you can't. You know, let's take a break real quick right there. The Ninth Circuit ruled what? It was kind of a narrow ruling. They can't something. What was that?
Well, it was more geared to the tribal police, where the tribal police were claiming that because these state highways that were going through tribal land were within tribal territory, that they could basically do whatever they wanted on those highways and didn't have to abide by constitutional limitations. And the Ninth Circuit said, no. For these highways that have been ceded to the state as state highways that go through tribal land, you are obligated to abide by both state and federal constitutional limitations with regards to any enforcement actions along those highways.
Yeah, well, and then here's some hundreds of thousands and shut up, and then you didn't shut up. Okay, so then you go, this guy's starting getting on the radio, and what he's doing, he's calling the deputy, all right, get ready to do whatever we're going to do, and what they do.
Right, so the deputy comes up, he drives his car up behind mine, he gets out, he walks up to me, and one of the first things that he does, he notices my recorders, all my cameras on the truck, and he says, are you a constitutionalist? That's his first question to me, okay? And I asked the deputy, I said, deputy, are you detaining me? He goes, no, I'm not detaining you. These federal agents are detaining you. I want to know why you're impeding traffic. And I said, deputy, you just answered your own question. These federal agents are illegally detaining me here in the lane of traffic. That's why I'm here. And so he was like, well, let me see your driver's license. And I said, are you detaining me? He goes, let me see your driver's license. I said, deputy, are you detaining me? He says, no, I'm not detaining you. And I said, then you don't have any basis to demand my driver's license. And he goes, well, tell me your name. I said, why do you need to know my name? He goes, well, tell me your name. I said, no. He goes, well, I just want to know who I'm talking to. I said, well, you don't need to know my name in order to talk to me. We're
you know, is this standard operating procedure? I hear this exact exchange all the time. And Mark Victor loves this stuff. That's how he gets, like, you know, money for Sheldon, 4409 for you. And David Eichner, he loves this kind of stuff, too. It helped you with the Kate. I mean, so anyway, so it goes back and forth, ouch, quit it, and then what?
Okay, so the deputy's clearly starting to get pissed off here. And I noticed that the supervisor is starting to get nervous, okay, because he knows the score here. So as the deputy is starting to ramp it up, okay, I hear the supervisor say, cut him loose. The deputy ignores him the first time, and the supervisor says again, cut him loose. I know who he is. The deputy ignores him again and demands my name again. And I continue to ask the deputy if he's detaining me. And he goes, well, look, I'm going to get your name anyway from your registration. Why don't you just tell me your name? I said, deputy, are you making overtime pay under federal operations Stone Garden here?
Ooh.
And he goes, listen, just get out of here. He goes,
no, skip to the end on that one.
right. He goes, just get out of here, okay? You're not answering my questions. Just leave. I said, okay, so I'm free to go? He goes, yes, I'm not stopping you. I said, okay, great. And as I'm pulling away, I hear him say, I will in a moment, though, okay?
Okay, now, wait. Now, when did they remove the stop sticks?
Well, this is what, you know, because I had actually forgotten about the stop strip, the spike strip during this interaction here. And it wasn't until afterwards that I'm thinking, geez, why weren't my tires blown out when I pulled away after the deputy told me to? I went back to the video, and I noticed that Agent Tackett, the agent who had thrown the spike strip down in front of my vehicle, as the deputy was coming up, he kind of very surreptitiously moved to the front of my vehicle, picked up a spike strip, and put it back in its container.
Oh, okay? Some bitch. Okay, okay.
Yeah, so, yeah. In fact, this became an issue because I realized after the fact that the deputy never even knew there was a spike strip there to begin with. They went back and they told him that I was blocking traffic without telling him that they had prevented me from moving by putting a spike strip in front of my vehicle.
God, you know, the judge has to be, you know, double face palming going, which side am I going to take on this, man? I mean, you know, I mean, I could be part of, I'm going to be in the Nuremberg trial here. Okay, so I'm going, so, we're hitting up on the break. See, this is good. This is good, 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 good. But it could have gone bad. Okay, and someday it may. I mean, you start rolling the dice 300 and something times. I mean, you know, it's going to be a Terry's going to be man. I hope you make it to retirement. I mean, telling you, we ain't even talked about with your wife. I mean, you know, we gotta see what she has to say. We'll talk about that during the break. You know, she's going to have an opinion. Of course, $250,000 doesn't hurt. You know, with her opinion, but you know, damn, she'd just rather have Terry being safe. We'll talk about more when we get back.
When it comes to investing in precious metals, you need a source you can trust who offers you choices and empowers you to maximize your wealth. That's where Roberts & Roberts Brokerage can help. Roberts & Roberts is a trusted name in precious metals. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts has been providing you with the finest gold and silver bullion, coins, rounds, and bars at genuine and honest prices. They make it easy to invest in precious metals and work with you to suit your investment needs. In addition to offering gold and silver for sale for U.S. dollars, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage is now accepting Bitcoin in exchange for their quality precious metals products. To speak with a professional from Roberts & Roberts about investing in precious metals, call toll-free 800-874-9760. Write this number down, 800-874-9760. Visit Roberts & Roberts online at rrbi.co. That's rrbi.co. On behalf of Roberts & Roberts, here's hoping your day is as good as gold.
You know, Terry, that's one thing I want to do. There should be, we got to have an award ceremony if you can make it till then, to where it's just two titanium balls with a, you know, string on a hook and a titanium testicle Terry award or something. Okay? Seriously, this is like, damn. And where that came from, God, I don't even remember who said it was. Yeah, you know, I used to, in the 90s, you know, all the crap that I used to do. Oh, the Ernie's got titanium testicles and kind of what. Man, I don't even have a freaking comparison to you. This is holy shit. All right. So I passed them on to you. Okay. So we're going to do it. Let me see. Really? Put it up. Put it up on the third hour. I want to see it. She's found the titanium testicle award already. You know, so the image guy, let me know when that's ready. I want to show that on here. Holy crap. You know, yep, see, like mines. All right, so let me see if I can pull up the show, because I definitely want to show this. Holy crap. Okay, how long is it going to take you, Donna? All right, well, let me know right when you get it, because I want to go to it. Okay, when we come back, I want to talk about your family and your wife and how much of this does she really know to even share with her. He's like, don't worry about it. I just got it. It's no big deal. It's no big deal. Or are you like every day, all day, telling her all the kind of, she's like, shut up. I mean, you know, so I want to get kind of the personal thing a little bit. And whatever you want to say about that, don't care. But we got to finish the story, okay? We'll come back with just a while. Yeah, she's whatever. You know, do your 30 seconds of, you know, homage to your family and support or so, but because I know you don't get to do this kind of stuff unless, you know, home is taken care of. And the other thing is that, you know, there's got to be at some point that's like, get the hell out of here, and then they stop you and you got to tell that story. Okay.
Right.
And then of course it's court and what the judge says, and I go court judge ruling on advisement or right then or then. Okay. All right, here we go. 30 seconds.
While our satellite channel is free to listen to, it's not free for us. You can help us cover our satellite costs with the chip-in on the right side of the page at lrn.fm.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Yeah.
we got to do is wait. Oh, Donna found it, got it up there. Terry gets this award, the Titanium Testicles Award. I tell you, you know where that came from, 90s. I used, you know, I'm doing this kind of crap, and they go, you know, the Ernie Titanium Testicle thing, and that was like a deal. And I go, you know what? We're going to come up with that award. I mean, actually, I'm going to pass it on, and I'm going to call it the, you know, the Terry Bressy Titanium Testicle Award or Titanium Testicle Terry Award or something. I mean, holy crap. All right. Now, the first thing, though, I mean, you can't do this if you don't have the support of, you know, friends and family and kind of, man, it definitely. And during all of this, you have, you know, you've had children, you've got, you know, a wife. You know, just give me a 20-seconder on, you know, mom. I mean, she says what?
You know, I don't try to hide the stuff from her, but I don't inundate her either. But she needs to know the type of, you know, dangerous scenarios that I get involved, that I have to put myself in order to go back and forth to work. So I, you know, I give her the basic lowdown as these incidents occur here. And of course, she's very concerned about me and wishes that there was a way, you know, in which I wasn't put into these scenarios. But unfortunately, that's not the world that we live in. So she is very supportive of what I have to do, but she's not very happy with the overall scenario.
Well, I mean, it's not, I mean, she understands, I mean, by this time, certainly after you had such notoriety and appreciation from people and awards and, you know, not guilties and Ninth Circuit and interplanetary appreciation of Titanium Testicle Awards. And she's kind of like, okay, well, this is my husband. I mean, you know, Donna goes through this, you know. But I tell you, I am not in the same position as you. I'm not looking at a guy with a badge and a gun at night stopping me with stop sticks and, you know, and a bunch of people and thou shalt, and you go, are you detaining me? I mean, you're the one that made that phrase famous, you know. Am I being detained? Am I being detained? Am I being detained? Whatever question you have, am I being detained? I just want to know who I'm talking about, being detained. I mean, this, and you emphasize this so much that it had a big impact on Sheldon, on other people, being detained. It's like, you know, Pastor Anderson, all these are like, damn it, it's that Terry Bressy, we should have shot him a long time ago. Okay, so I'm going, damn, they would have just, if they'd known where this was going, they would have gave up one of their own for whatever level of punishment or whatever to shut Terry up. And the thing is if it wasn't for video, if it wasn't for the technology that's come up to free us more, this would not have happened this way. And I'm glad you were able to use this. Thank you. I just want to say thank you. For my grandchildren, I want to say thank you, Terry Bressy. But let's go ahead and finish this real quick. From the time that they said, all right, you're being let go. I mean, at what point did they finally in the conversation with the deputy, you got the supervisor of the Border Patrol, I know who he is, let him go. He's seeing this amp up. They called the law enforcement over, and they're going to get some. He's going, ooh, we're going to amp it, we're going to get some. He already knew where this was going. He's like, man, we don't want to go down this road. Tell me what happened from there, and then we'll get into the, you know, the stop and the court and the judge and the verdict and everything. Start from there, go.
So between the checkpoint and Three Points, Arizona, there's probably about 3 miles or so. So I didn't even make it to Three Points, Arizona before Deputy Avila with a
Okay, now wait. We haven't got to the you can go yet. You know, they said, all right, just get out of here. And then he said under his breath, he said something. What did he say?
He said, when I asked him if I was free to go, he said, I'm not stopping you. But then as I'm starting to pull away, he said under his breath, I will go in a minute. Okay.
Son of a bitch.
Oh, yeah.
Did that come out in court?
Yes, it did.
All right. So it's on record. All right. So and then you leave and you go, damn, I'm glad that stop strip was taken. Okay. So you're going down the road, and how long and how far before they stop you?
I don't think I made it a mile down the road before Deputy Avila was on my tail with his lights on. So mile and a half from the checkpoint.
And you knew they were going to come get you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So I'm actually fiddling with my phone there, trying to get the phone, and get someone online there. So I pull over, and Avila comes up to the passenger side window. In fact, I've got cameras, you know, set up all around my truck. I've got one up going out the passenger window, out the driver's window, out the front and the back. So I've got all four directions covered there.
Now, is this a personal truck or is this University of Arizona truck?
This is a personal truck.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So,
but it has been with the University truck before.
Yes, but I haven't driven in a university vehicle back and forth since probably 2009. In fact, this was an issue of contention that arose that the union tried to use against me, trying to claim that the university was supporting my actions because I was driving a university vehicle. So one of the agreements that I made with the university was that I would use my own vehicle driving back and forth.
Okay, so he pulls you. Here comes the deputy, and he says, hello.
It wasn't quite that nice. So he comes up to the passenger side window, demands that I roll down the window. I roll it down partway, and I demand to know why he's pulled me over. He goes, either roll the window all the way down, or you're getting out of the vehicle. So I roll the window all the way down, and he shoves my camera. I've got it on the visor, you know, pointing in his direction. He shoves it out of the way, and then he starts to lecture me, right? So I said, Deputy, I want to know now why you've pulled me over. He goes, I'll tell you that in a minute. I go, no, I want to know right now. And he goes, well, for honking your horn back at the checkpoint. I said, you've got to be kidding me. How long did it take you to pull that one out of your rear end? And at the same time, I have my phone going. I've got this automated Bluetooth thing going, and it's talking on its own in the background, and he goes, turn off the phone. And I ignore him, and he says, turn off the phone now or get out. And he says, and he didn't give me any time to do anything. He says, okay, get out of the vehicle right now. So he walks over to the other side. I get out. I roll up my windows, lock the door, leave the keys in there. I get out, and we walk back to the back of my truck.
Okay, now this is an important point. When they do this, then they got to get, you know, probable cause to search, to get in. I imagine you have backup keys somewhere. But the point is that you go, I'm getting out of the vehicle. You lock it up, leave the keys inside. Why?
Because I didn't want to, so that he would not have the capability of getting into the vehicle without breaking a window, to make it very clear that I did not give him consent to search.
Man, you're just one of them, man. You constitutionalist or whatever the hell they want to call you. You know, all right. So then you walk back your vehicle, and then what?
So he starts, just as he's demanding my driver's license, lo and behold, one of the agents at the checkpoint pulls in with his Border Patrol patrol car behind the deputy.
Dude, come save your ass.
Over.
I mean, he's coming out. He's like, oh, I already know where this goes. You know, was he there for you or for him, or why do you think he came?
Well, I eventually got the agent to say that he was there as backup for the deputy.
Yeah. Okay, but, so he comes there, and then we're going to run out of time. I know it.
Yeah.
But the thing is that we're going to continue this. You guys just go to the archive. Yeah, it sucks to be you. Go to the archive, and you're going to have to get the rest of this story. The bottom line is this. He was given a ticket for honking the horn. It goes to court. Not guilty, done. But there's a lot more to the story. Go ahead and continue the story.
So I went to court.
No. Oh, I mean, okay. go to the back of the vehicle, and then what?
Okay, all right. So I immediately demand the name of the agent who's there, because he's a witness, and it also makes it very clear that this isn't just a Pima County Sheriff deputy thing, that this is a joint operation between the county sheriff and the Border Patrol. Because now we have Border Patrol agents who have gone from their assigned duty station at the checkpoint to divert to this, what Avila is claiming is just the Pima County Sheriff's Department issue, right? So now we got the Border Patrol there. I'm demanding his name, and the deputy, he says to me, ignore him. He is not part of this traffic stop. Ignore him. And I said, I'm not going to ignore him. He's a witness. He was at the checkpoint. And this whole thing started at the checkpoint. I'm not going to ignore him. I want his name. I want his name now. So, of course, the deputy says, well, you can get his name after we're done.
Okay, was this being recorded in any way?
Oh, yes. So I've got a camera on my chest, and I've got my pivot head sunglasses with video on it.
God, you're just a pain in the ass, man. Okay, so then, all right. I don't want the music to, you know, mess this up. Terry, I am just so glad that this is, you know, there's going to be, like, documentaries, okay? There's going to be, you know, the made-for-TV hero of, and your kids are going to learn. They have no idea how important your efforts are. I understand. I've been covering you for over a decade, from the very first end in 03, just months after your first stop, because I understood how important, and the other things that you have brought out, like the equipment that they use. This is like a test bed for We Rule You Nazi Checkpoint kind of crap that be a coming. And the only thing that even slowed it down just long enough for us to know what's going on, Terry Bressy, CheckpointUSA.org. Okay, now we got unlimited time. We can do it. And everybody going to the archive and watching the video. And we can relax and finish the story. Now, how much time do you have? Do you have to go somewhere?
I eventually have to go into work this morning, but I've got a little bit of time.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and finish the story. So now you're back there. No, I'm not going to ignore this guy. He's here. He's a witness. Pick it up from there. What's up?
So the deputy basically says, look, he says, you can ask the agent all the questions that you want after we get done with this traffic stop here. And he goes, show me, he said, show me your driver's license. And I said, my driver's license and documentation is in my truck. And Avia says, okay, let's go back to the truck. And before we started back to the truck, I said, I want this well understood right now. You do not have consent to search me. You do not have consent to search my vehicle. And you do not have consent to enter my vehicle. Is that clear? And he said, yes, that's clear. So we walk back to the vehicle. I start to, I've got a keypad on the driver's side, so I don't actually need a key. I can just enter a code. So I start to enter the code to unlock the door to go in and get my driver's license. And he says, and Avia says, he asked me, do you have any weapons in the vehicle? And I just turn around and I look at him and I don't say a word. And he goes, do you have any weapons in the vehicle? I said, deputy, do you want me to get my driver's license or not? He goes, I'm just letting you know, if you reach for anything in there, there's going to be trouble. I said, deputy, you've asked me to get this documentation for you. It's somewhere in my vehicle. I'm not quite sure offhand where it is, so that means I have to reach for things. I said, do you want me to get my driver's license or not? And he goes, well, I'm going to be watching you. I said, watch me away. And so I went in, I found my driver's license and the registration and then turned around and gave it to him. He looked it over. He said, all right, hold here. I'm going to go check on it. He went back to his patrol car to pull up the information. So I'm sitting there. And
okay, now let's pause there for a second. He goes back to his car. By this time, it's obvious that he didn't really understand what he was dealing with. Did he know who you were? Did he got the memo? How long has he been part of this Stone Garden project? I mean, did this come up in trial? I mean, how much experience did he have in dealing with Terry?
He didn't have any. I pulled up his, I did an open records request with the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board to get all his certification records. He was hired by the Pima County Sheriff's Department sometime in middle or late to 2011, so he's only been a deputy for a couple of years. And it was pretty clear that he didn't know anything about me until he showed up in court. I think he knew at that time that he had probably jumped in a little deeper than he wanted to.
Yeah, no, I mean, if he had an opportunity to, you know, I want to make this clear, okay? You play these games, you got to be very careful, because I've done a lot of this kind of stuff, and I have people got arrested, they get in trouble. I'm sure you hear a lot, well, I did what Terry did, and it didn't go. No, they got all full of hubris and thought that they could get away with my being detained, and all of a sudden they wind up, it didn't work out as well, because they're not as experienced as you are. And the thing is that I want to make sure that they understand, and I tell this story all the time, dealing with government agents like this is like playing chess with a three-year-old. It's very easy to beat them. It's how you understand intellectually, but sooner or later, they stand up on their chair, knock all the pieces on the floor, and pump 3 45 slugs in your chest. So this is, it always is the threat. You're probably better off that the Border Patrol guy was there and that you're videotaping and that they know, you know, they're kind of worried, is it broadcasting? Is it going up on the internet? Is it being, you know, accumulated somewhere? Kind of whatever. But if there was an opportunity in the circumstances, and God forbid it was night, the scenario may have been very different. Am I correct?
You are absolutely correct. And although it may sound like I'm, you know, that I'm taking all this lightly, I don't. These are very serious encounters. Every time I go to that checkpoint, I have no idea what to expect.
It's very intimidating. It's very stressful every time I have to go through, just because of the fact that, like you said, these agents, they're unpredictable. You don't know how they're going to react. You don't know what their personality types are. You don't know if they're just going to go off the deep end and take action that is going to have severe consequences for you further down the line there.
Wow, this is, you are the man. I mean, this is, you know, can you imagine this being done in Germany in the 30s, early 40s? I mean, this is man Juden, constitutionalist. Might as well just have something on your sleeve. I mean, damn. Okay, so all right. So you go in, you get your information. He gets it, and he goes back to his car, and then what?
He goes back to his car, so I'm sitting, you know, behind my truck waiting for him to come back, and three more Border Patrol vehicles pull in behind the first one. So now we've got four Border Patrol vehicles and a county deputy and my truck all on the side of the road, right? And
why do you think they were there? Why do you really think they came?
Ah, geez. You know, that's a good question. I think maybe to keep an eye on what was happening, because I think the supervisor realized that if this thing got too big, that it would feed back
directly
to the Border Patrol.
Because he's the one that got on the phone and called this deputy to come up and give you what for, and it didn't go to it. It's just like, you don't call the cops, okay?
Yeah.
This is why. And he called him, Gage. He's like, yeah, my butt's on the line on this one. So they go, I bet you they were there, just like when we deal with a confrontation prevention squad of the Phoenix police or their social, whatever, the community service, PR, what the hell. They come to protect them. They're not there to protect our rights. The confrontation prevention is so they don't get sued. So I can see, I know this attitude. I've been through this before. They came to, you know, make sure that you were okay, because it was going to bounce back on them, in my opinion. Okay?
Yeah, that was part of it. That was definitely part of it. I'm, of course, demanding the names. So two more agents get out of the, you know, of the truck, and they come over and they start talking with the first agent who's been standing there. And they're all kind of huddling together and talking. And I take a couple steps towards them. And I say, hey, what's your name? So I want the names of each of you agents here. And they just kind of ignore me. But while I'm asking for their names, the deputy gets out of his car. Right, he's still running my information, and he runs over and he gets between me and the agents, and he says, "Back up right now! Get back to the back of your vehicle. Ignore these agents." And I said, "What did I say?" And the deputy said something about me, like interfering or not allowing the traffic stop, you know, to run its course there. And I said, and he says, go back and sit on the bumper of your truck. And I said, deputy, why don't you order these agents over here to go back and sit on the back of their vehicles? If they're not involved with this checkpoint, as you claim, or with this traffic stop, like you claim, then they have no business being here. They're interfering with this traffic stop. And he goes, oh, they're not interfering with my traffic stop. And I said, of course they're not. Of course they're not. But I got it all on record that, you know, he's allowing these federal agents to have full access to this traffic stop while refusing to allow me the opportunity to get the names of the agents so that I have them as witnesses and that sort of thing for later legal action. So I just wanted to make sure that was established on the record. So
see, this is why people shouldn't take this like just think you're going to run out and I get some video cam. I got my cam, kind of whatever, and do the Terry Bressy thing. He's been doing this for a decade, going through all the court, reading, shepherdizing, checking precedent and case law and making case law. To think you're just going to run out and do this stuff, don't be a fool. Okay, know what you're doing, and you know, am I being detained? Is fine. I mean, at some point, you know, you got to, oh, Terry, you know, you need to, is there a book? I mean, we'll get to that later. Okay, so we'll go get the, you write the book. But, you know, just to answer that, are you preparing? I mean, that's kind of what your site really is education on this. But, I mean, I need a book.
You know, there is so much that I'd like to do and so many places I'd like to go with checkpointusa.org. But, you know, I'm time constrained at every turn. You know, I have a very fulfilling but demanding job. You know, it's very technically orientated. It takes a lot of my time, that I have to plan for projects and whatnot. I have a full family life. I have two young children. I have, a
that
family.
That you're doing this for. See, the thing is I know you understand being a libertarian activist kind of, since you were in college. I mean, you got all kinds of, you know, I don't respect your authority because you got a badge. And this is where it goes. And there's an entire new generation of young people that are coming up in this environment and understanding that, which you've been a big inspiration to so many people. It's just that I know what happens. They get away with a lot of it, but sometimes they do, they're stupid. They don't have enough video camera, the backup of the video and the guy videotaping the videotaper of whatever they're doing. And then all of a sudden, then it's at night and they get in trouble. So I don't want to, you know, this, I just want to make it clear. This is not for the light of, you know, the faint of heart, man. I mean, you know, this is serious stuff. So anyway, so they go ahead. He's back there. He comes up. You're not allowed to talk to these guys. And eventually he gets done writing a ticket. From the time that he stopped you to the time that you leave, how long was the encounter on the side of the road?
It was about 30 minutes.
Damn. Okay. So you're doing this. He finally, you're not allowed to talk to them. Pick it up there.
Right. So, the deputy goes back to his, car. He finishes running my information, writes up a ticket. He comes back to me and he says to me, he goes, okay, this is going to conclude our interaction or my involvement with this case. And I said, deputy, you got it wrong. It will not conclude our interaction with this particular incident. And he just kind of looked at me a little bit quizzically, not quite understanding what I was saying. But anyway, so he gave me the ticket, explained the ticket to me, and gave me the time I was supposed to appear in court. And I said,
well, what did he explain to you? He goes, you honked your horn. I mean, I don't understand what the, you know, how would he even justify that?
Well, you know, he said, I'm writing you a ticket for violations of 28-954B under the Arizona Revised Statutes. This is for excessively honking your horn. And I said, you know, I said basically that,
define,
you know,
excessive.
this was a bullshit type of violation report that you're writing up here. I said, I have, not only did I have a right to honk my horn because I was notifying other travelers of a safety condition created by the Border Patrol back at the checkpoint, but I also have a First Amendment right to express myself with regards to the treatment that I was receiving at the checkpoint.
Which is case law.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
He didn't know or whatever. I mean, you know, digging that hole. Okay. So so this conversation went on past that?
It went on a little bit further. I said, deputy, I said, since you seem to be, you know, here because you're allegedly enforcing state and county laws here, I said, have you by chance had an opportunity to review the encroachment permit that the Border Patrol is required to have on the premises in order to operate that checkpoint back there? He said, huh?
Okay, encroachment permit, what?
An encroachment permit. So the Border Patrol, get this, they have to apply for a permit from the Arizona Department of Transportation. It's called an encroachment permit before they can set up an operation along a state highway, okay? And I've been running these open records requests for a couple years now where I've identified 13 different Border Patrol checkpoint sites around Arizona. And most of the checkpoint encroachment permits that they've applied for and been granted permission to run
have
been set up under the premises that they are temporary or tactical checkpoints. And as such, they can only be operated they can't be operated all the time. They can only be operated intermittently during certain times of the year. But as my videos have shown, they operate these checkpoints 24/7, 365 days every year. So they're already in violation of these encroachment permits. So I asked the deputy, I said, deputy, have you had a chance to look over these encroachment permits to see if they have a valid current permit on the premises? These permits have to be renewed annually. And B, whether or not they're in compliance with all of the restrictions placed upon their operations for these permits. He goes, well, I don't enforce those laws. I said, deputy, I said, aren't you tasked as a Pima County Sheriff's Department deputy with enforcing the rules and regulations and laws of the state, the county, and the local, of the state and the county? He
goes, just horn honking.
Yes.
Just horn honking.
And he said, "Well, he said, well, I'm not dealing with any of those issues here. I'm just, you know, this is just has to do with your horn honking."
Yeah, I've reduced myself to a horn honking deputy. I mean,
right,
come
right,
on,
right, right, right.
Okay,
exactly.
Okay.
So, So he goes, I'm done talking to you, okay? So he turns around and he starts to walk back to his vehicle. And I said, Deputy, how does it feel to be the lapdog for the United States Border Patrol? And he ignored me. He got back into his patrol car.
Nah, I don't know if I would have threw that last one. But, you know, okay, whatever makes you feel better. Now,
wait, I'm actually not done yet, okay? This goes on a little bit further. He gets back into his patrol car. He starts to drive away, and I walk towards the Border Patrol agent who was there. And I go, Agent, I want to know your name. He turns around. He walks away from me quickly, gets into his vehicle, and he follows the deputy back onto SR-86, okay? So I figure everything's done now, okay? I get back in my truck. I take a deep breath. You know, I pull back out of the road, and I start to drive back to Tucson. As I get towards Three Points, Arizona, the Border Patrol has a substation just outside of Three Points, Arizona, where they have all their logistical staging grounds, where all the agents, you know, park their vehicles, and they've got the Border Patrol vehicles and the towers and the tents and everything else set up there. And lo and behold, the deputy who just wrote me the ticket and the agent from the checkpoint were pulled off into the parking area of the Border Patrol substation talking. Right? And also, I don't think I emphasize this enough, I had asked the deputy several times what the name of the agent was himself, okay? And the deputy said, well, I don't know who he is. I don't know his name. I've never interacted with him before, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, did you get video of them talking?
Oh, yeah. I've got this all on video. No. So I drive by really slow, taking the video, and they're talking side by side, and then I pull into the parking lot, okay? And I pull up to the deputy, and I rolled down the window, and I said, Deputy, do you still not know the name of the agent that you're talking to? And the deputy gets all pissed, and he says, you're blocking my egress route. Move out of the way now. So I back up my vehicle, and I get out, and I start to walk over to him. I said, Deputy, I thought you told me that you don't know the name of this agent. What are you guys talking about over here? And he goes, are you harassing this federal agent? Are you harassing this federal agent? I said, Deputy. I said, this agent is a witness to what just transpired back here. I need to know his name so that I can have him properly subpoenaed when we go to court over this issue.
And then what?
And then what? He goes...
When did the gunfire start? I just want to know that. Okay?
He goes, are you a lawyer? I said, Deputy, do you want to find out... And he goes, you obviously like to talk, you obviously like to talk in the court a lot, so I'm done talking to you. We're done here, and I'm leaving. And he drove away, right? So once again, I turn to the agent who's still parked there, and I start to walk towards him. He puts his vehicle in reverse, okay, and drives in reverse to get away from me, and then drives out the other exit of the parking lot.
Well, of course, you find out who he is, and you know this, you got a picture of him, whatever. That comes out, right?
Well, I never found out this particular agent's name, but I certainly do have his picture. So,
seriously, in the court, it never comes out? Nobody, I mean, of course, it's on, you know, all these pictures we're running now, but wow.
Yes. So I showed up in court there, and of course I've got...
Okay, now before we get to court, I want to ask a question. Has any of your other experiences dealing with ever escalated... I mean, you've gone through a lot of stuff. Is this one had a different flavor to it than the others, or is it just one of the many like this?
With regards to the Border Patrol itself, it's very similar to any number of other encounters that I've had with them. With regards to the county sheriff, I had a previous... If you remember last year, I had a very similar type of interaction with a county sheriff's deputy who had been called out to the checkpoint, and they wrote me a citation for stopping unnecessarily in the lane of traffic.
Same old. Yeah. You learnified them on that one, too. I mean, you're just a training manual. You know that, right?
Yeah.
how to suppress and take down and kick the living crap out of citizenry of America, kind of, 101, what we learned by Terry, okay? And sooner or later, they're going, yeah, we perfected it. Thanks, Terry. But hopefully by that time, we'll have, the social pressures and the PR and the understanding and the people hazing up, did it just in time, you know, because you delayed them just long enough that we kind of got a beat on it, and it becomes a political issue, so, and a cultural thing. So thank you. I do think that you're, you know, there's a long-term effect of what you're doing, so I just want to say thank you again. I mean, seriously, I've been following. See, I knew who you are and how you've been doing it for over a decade. You know, I know that I'm going, you know, they have no idea what they, and anything that they do, they ever really have some kind of something happens to Terry, it will rise up. There'll be some rising up, and I don't think they really. I think they're starting to get it now, though. I mean, just the social pressure, especially after Snowden and all this other stuff. But damn, I mean, stay safe, man. Seriously, but go ahead and I guess it's all video. But the you go to court, and then what? Now, first off, this happened in April, and you wanted to do some traveling, or you had vacation, so you kind of put it off a little bit because, hey, man, I'm going to let it interrupt my life, and we'll get to it whenever. So you go, and finally, you get the court win.
I went to court on July 11th.
So this is very recent. Okay. So you go to court and say, all right, here we go. Did you do any discovery? Did you have any what? I mean, how did you prep for it?
You know, last time around, I had put in a motion for discovery, but it came to naught because the deputy never actually showed up for the court appearance back last year when I did this. This year, I didn't have time because I was gone for about a month and a half on vacation and doing some other stuff here. So I didn't really have time to, you know, to get, because for a traffic citation, by default, you're not allowed to do discovery. You have to put in a motion and ask special permission to do discovery. Under and claim special circumstances, and I think there's plenty of special circumstances.
Under what?
Here.
I mean, a discovery under. I mean, for what? Just traffic violation stuff, or what are you talking about?
Well, in this case here, I wanted to get discovery from the Pima County Sheriff's Department for all their Operation Stone Garden documentation. I wanted to see how many deployments.
Oh, hell no. That is, man, you opened up the can of whip-ass on that. They did not want to play, I'll bet you. Okay, so we ain't even got to the court thing yet. Okay, let's talk about the Stone Garden thing. Has that come up in your previous effort? I think the last one you brought that up, right?
Yes. Last time around, I actually did an open records request to the County Sheriff's Department, and after they jerked me around for a couple of months, I finally got them to release a 12-page document that showed the grant award from the Department of Homeland Security. Okay, and within that grant award, though, it identified a whole bunch of other documentation that I became very interested in that I didn't even know existed at the time. So this time around, I've also submitted another open records request to the county sheriff, and I said, not only do I want a copy of the grant award from the Homeland Security, I want to see your application that you put forward. I want to see all the quarterly reports that you've been required to file with the Department of Homeland Security. I want to see all of the property forms for any equipment that you've been purchased under these grant awards. I want to see all deployment schedules for all county deputies who have been getting overtime pay from this grant. I want to see all reimbursement schedules for deputies and how much they've been earning in overtime from these grant awards, and it goes so forth and so on. So, of course, the county sheriff ignored my request for the first 2 months. And shortly after I got back from my road trip there, I called the department. I said, hey, what's up with my open records request? And they said, it's been forwarded on to the administration office, and it's been sitting there for the last, you know, couple of months. And I said, well, okay, I'll give you guys a couple more days to respond to me before I file special action in the Superior Court for denial of my open records request. And then within a couple of days, I get a call from a special tactical lieutenant saying that he's working on my open records request, and that currently it's going to cost me $465 because of the amount of documentation that I've requested. I said, well, okay, well, give me a breakdown of the fees that you're charging me. And he said, well, we're going to charge you for multiple hours worth of processing and redaction time, along with, you know, a per page copy and stuff like that. And
so I'm going to pay you to redact?
Right. So I said, Lieutenant, I said, are you familiar with the open records law here in Arizona? I said, you can only charge me preparation and redaction fees if I'm making a request for commercial purposes. I said, in my request to you, I made it clear that this was a non-commercial open records request. And what that means is that you're only allowed to charge me
Per paper or printing or something.
Right, exactly. And he goes, well, according to our policy, I can charge you for these other things. And I said, well, you may want to review that before you make a final decision here. And he said, okay, I'll look it over and get back to you. So a couple days later, I get a call from the record supervisor at the County Sheriff's Department, and she says, okay, we're going to charge you $82, you know, for all these, for all this documentation and for 3 hours worth of preparation time. And I said, no.
They just get the charge if just for the paper. It's per page.
Right,
I've been through this before.
Right. And she wouldn't budge. I said, okay. I said, this is what I need you to do. I need you to send me a document that breaks down the fees that you're charging me. I said, you're going to be hearing from me with regards to this issue here. And she said, okay. And she didn't indeed send it to me. So I've got this document now that shows that they're trying to charge me preparation and redaction fees when the law says they can't do it. So I'm going to be prepping a complaint to the Superior Court and try to compel them to release the documentation.
And of course, you got all this documented on your web page of where you're at in the stage of and your more training of the agents.
Well, I have a lot of information that I still need to post up on my website, which I haven't got around to yet. So it takes, as you know, a little bit of time to prep all this stuff, and I'm still in the mode of actually trying to do it. And once I get it done, then I'll be able to have time to sit down and actually show what I've done online. So.
Wow. Okay. So, in the end, we'll wind up, it's just, you know, how much you're going to pay and how much redaction and how much, and you already cost them gazillions of dollars of whatever, and they could have just done it and whatever. So, they, man. They are not in this to serve what they're supposed to do or even what the law says, and you're just going through and giving them a lesson, but in the end, they'll go, and never have that document. Never pass that, never put it in the file, never. Because this Stone Garden thing, this is, I think, from your efforts is where it started hitting national. Hell, I know Alex Jones was all over this thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're absolutely right in that, you know, they can ultimately deny and claim, you know, that documents don't exist. But the more people that are paying attention, and geez, I'm hoping people who are listening to this, you know, everyone should make up their own open records request to the Arizona Department of Homeland Security. Say, hey, we want to know what other local law enforcement agencies are getting grant awards under these federal programs. You know?
It's very easy. I mean, you could do it on the back of a napkin. It's ARS something 121, whatever the hell it is.
32-128, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been through this before. They want to play. I go, all right, let's play. And then it becomes standing for a lawsuit to go and kind of drag. I'm going, I just need a government number to, you know, go whip ass on y'all. But after a point, it gets to the point where you just know that, you know, does everybody understand that they're scumbags? I don't want everybody to understand it. Everybody understand that? Well, then I'm done. You know, I go, okay, they're scumbags. But the thing is that you are, I mean, damn. You know, there is not, you're like, and what kind of scumbags? and where their scumbag is shall on. You know, I mean, it's kind of, okay. So then you go, you do all this. You don't get the Freedom of Information yet. We're still going through this process, and I'm glad you're doing that because this is good information we need to understand. But you know, all of a sudden, you got them, and they get a compliance officer or somebody's got to fill out the right form, and damn it. I mean, just the fact the way you asked the question, they got somebody meeting with somebody about something. So in the meantime, you go to court, and what happens?
Yeah, so the court hearing was very interesting. I really didn't know what to expect. And of course, you know, they send me the subpoena beforehand and say, you know, appear on this date at this time, and you've been basically allocated 5 minutes for your hearing. I'm thinking, no, this is going to take a little bit longer than 5 minutes. So, you know, I had fully prepped. I had a 14-page written statement ready to go, and then 10 exhibits to go along with that, those 14 pages of my written statement, okay? And in addition, I had prepared about 3 or 4 pages worth of cross-examination questions for Deputy Avila. So I'm fully prepped and ready to go here. I've got about 100 pages worth of stuff that I'm ready to show the court. And I show up for the hearing, You know, about half an hour early there, sitting in the room watching some of the other cases. Deputy Avila comes in, and he's sitting in the back over on the other side, and I walk up to him. I lean down and say, Deputy Avila, under Rule 13, I am required to provide you copies for your review of all the written documentation that I've prepared. And I had made a copy of everything for him. I said, so this is my Rule 13 disclosure to you. And he kind of has this really weird look on his face, like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, he had no clue, you know, as to regards to court procedure or what he was required to do or whatnot. He goes, don't give me that. He said, I don't want to look at it. I said, so you are acknowledging that I have met my obligation under Rule 13 to give you the opportunity to review these documents, and you've chosen not to. He said, whatever. It goes, you know, whatever. I said, in reverse, Deputy, I am exercising my right to review any written documentation that you've brought with you today. And he goes, do you have any documentation that you wish to present to me for review at this time? And he just, you know, gave me another one of those looks and like, get away from me type of thing, you know.
Okay, wait. I'm pulling up your site here, and John Stossel just did this Policing America, you know, police state thing that just aired. Were you part of that?
You know, I got called by the Stossel Show several months ago, and they said they wanted to do a segment with me, and that they were going to come out with their camera crews. And I said, great, okay, you know, let's set it up. And then I didn't hear anything for, you know, several weeks. And then finally, the producer got back to me and said, look, we're not going to be able to send a camera crew out, but we're willing to fly you out to New York so that you can do a segment with John Stossel. And I didn't have enough headway time to do that. And, of course, it's the whole TSA thing there. I said, you know, I've got pretty strict limitations on my time for work. And also, I'm not big on flying. So I said, if you could wait until June, I'll be out there in June, you know, on a family road trip. I'll be more than happy to stop by then. He said, no, that won't work for us. I said, okay, well, I know a couple other guys that you may want to talk to. And I pointed them to Rick Reinierson, and he is the Air Force pilot who has a lawsuit against the Border Patrol for an unlawful detention back in 2010. And if you look down on my website, you'll see a couple links to those.
But did they use any of your footage?
They used a little bit of my footage in the video, and you can hear me saying, am I being detained? Am I being detained? And when the video's there.
So you made it into it. You got a little bit of Terry.
Right.
Ha!
Yeah.
Ha, 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 ha. Okay. So anyway, the officer, you asked him if he had anything for you to look at. Did he bring any papers or anything for you to look at?
He claimed he didn't have anything, and I got him on this later. So so the hearing starts, and I said to the judge, or the hearing officer, I said, I'm making a Rule 13 invocation here. I want it to be on the record that I've given Deputy Avila an opportunity to review all of my written documentation here. He has declined that opportunity to review it. I've also asked that Deputy Avila allow me to review any police notes or any written documentation that he's brought with him. And the judge asked the deputy, said, Deputy, did you bring any documentation with you? And the deputy said, no, I did not. But he actually did. And I got him on it later.
Wow. I mean, you know, wow. Man, he was digging a hole. Well, what was it that he did bring later?
Well, he had brought, of course, they have to do a full incident report every time they have a thing like this, right? And, in fact, in my open records request, I had specifically requested all of Avila's documentation from the encounter in question, including the incident report. And this is a formal written thing that goes into the Pima County Sheriff's Department, you know, computer system, okay? And during my cross-examination, I asked Avila if he had created a incident report with regards to this encounter, and he said, yes, he did. And I asked him, did you bring it with you today? And he said, yes, he did. And then I turned to the judge. I said, Judge, I said, at the beginning of this hearing, I specifically asked to review any written documentation under Rule 13 that the deputy had brought with him. He claimed at that time that he hadn't brought anything with him, but now he's claiming that he does indeed have a copy of his written incident report here. I said, I would like it in the record that Deputy Avila violated Rule 13 that I specifically invoked at the beginning of this hearing. And the judge said, so noted.
I, you know, this deputy, he don't want to play open garden anymore, I imagine.
Well, you know, you're going to make it difficult for him, you know.
There's like, you know, they're going to have, he has a, you know, a gym buddy, partner, somebody, something, and either stay away from Terry or get him in town of the Tucson police kind of something. I mean, they are, this has been my opinion. In the past, when I deal with the Confrontation Prevention Squad, you know, in Phoenix, this guy for over 20 years I've been dealing with, his name, Al Ramirez. I don't even know if he's still there. The last time he contacted me, it was a cryptic message. I still have it on my phone. And he goes, Ernie, this is Al Ramirez. He goes, FYI, I am calling from Sergeant What's-a-So in line, and kind of which meant it's being recorded, and from now on they will not be talking to me unless it's through the channels of You're Not Allowed. And I'm going, all right, I get it. Now, where Al and I before have always had, the goal was, is to not have anybody die. You know, we have all the kinds of different protests and things that go on, and we're going through the pride, and we're showing in the signs and kind of nobody, hey, and word up and peace. And he's there to keep the hothead just straight from Afghanistan and Iraq and got to respect my authority kind of crap, Avila, what you're dealing with, and kind of keep them, don't be stupid. So he and I, you know, I'm kind of repping everybody, you know, they're doing their chest out thing, and I ain't going to go, don't be stupid. Stay off of the street, stay on the side, you know, so I'm kind of taking care of them, don't be stupid. He's doing the same thing without, yeah, don't be stupid, so nobody's stupid, okay? This is, but the attitude is getting to the point now that I could tell from Al. He's like, yeah, we're not in charge anymore. I could just feel it. You know, it's coming from the Department of the Fusion of We Rule You people, okay?
Right.
And they're putting people in positions, and his new supervisor, his older supervisor, the other guy was before, I think his name was Brian, he was cool. Yeah, we're here to keep the peace. It's all good. You know what? Put me on the beat, and I'll work nights and weekends and whatever. You know, I am not playing this game. I could just feel he decided he's going to go over here. And it was during this, there's a whole bunch of stuff that was going on, but I can see why he was a decent guy. Well, now they're bringing in the boy that was head of the, you know, the sniper team of the diplomat protection, Obama coming kind of we rule you guy, you know, and did the Occupy thing and the rest and all this kind of, and I'm going, damn, we're getting militarized, and this is now all federal agent fusion kind of whatever the hell. And when it goes from the federal and Terry's a pain in the ass, don't ever think that you're going to be safe from whatever and just keep your, you got your video camera and glasses and everything on all the time?
I do, and that's the thing that I want you especially to be aware of. I not only have one camera running when I go to these checkpoints, I have four or five at any given time. So if they ever claim, you know, after, you know, I've been riddled with bullets that I did something and, oh, there's no video evidence, they're lying through their teeth. I get four or five cameras that are running, and that means at least one of them is going to be operational, you know. So they can't claim, oh, they we lost the video or the cameras weren't working or blah, blah, blah. No, there's four or five cameras running.
Okay, so then okay. You get the judge to say, yep, he violated lying sack of snot. And did he question the officer or say, yeah, what about that? Or the officer, what was his response to that?
The judge didn't delve into it any more deeply than what I presented. So he allowed it to be entered into the record, and that was good enough for me.
Okay, well,
and
what did the officer do or say? Like, damn it, you know, one more reason to, you know, slit Terry's tires? I mean, what?
he didn't say anything. I mean, there's really nothing he could say, you know.
No repercussions on these guys to do. They do this constantly. They just do whatever the hell they can say, whatever they, you know. All right. So, So then what happens? You get through testimony. This is what happened. This is what happened. This is what happened. And how long did you give your opening and your case and whatever and cross? And how long did that go?
Yeah, well, this is pretty interesting here. So, of course, the deputy during these types of encounters, because the defendant always gets to have a last word, basically. So the deputy testified first, and he testified for about 5 minutes or so. And his whole strategy was to try to he objected to my reference to the checkpoint, basically, and any evidence that I brought with regards to the checkpoint. He declared that this was nothing more than a Pima County Sheriff's Department traffic stop with a horn-honking incident that just happened to be at the checkpoint. And therefore, anything that I brought up with regards to the checkpoint itself should be inadmissible because it has nothing to do with a traffic stop.
Now, did he have an attorney, or was it just him?
It was just him. It was just him. And I said, no. I said, Judge, this deputy is being paid specifically under a federal grant, Operation Stone Guard, and exhibit number two here, where he's being paid time and a half by the Border Patrol in order to be at the Border Patrol checkpoint. He's not there on Pima County Sheriff's business. He's there on Border Patrol business. That's the whole reason why he's there and the whole reason why he's getting paid time and a half. And the deputy was like, no, no. He says, no, this is just an augmentation. This is just an augmentation of standard Pima County Sheriff's patrols. And I said, Judge, please look at exhibit number three here. Exhibit number three is from the Arizona Department of Homeland Security, where they lay out the terms of these federal grants. And one of the terms is that the money being utilized to pay overtime paid to deputies cannot be utilized to augment existing county patrols.
Holy shit.
To be used for Border Patrol purposes. You know, I mean, and this is one of the reasons why it's so important to do your homework, okay? Because if you don't know this stuff inside and out, you can't refute it, you know, when it, you know, when it's brought up in court or in public. But because I know this stuff so well, and I do my homework, and I do the open records request, and even though I don't get everything that I want, I get enough, I can, in a split second, I can say, no, he is full of shit. This is why, look right here, this is the documentation from, you know, from the Homeland Security Department, from the grant award letter that says, no, this is not for county sheriff's purposes. This is for Border Patrol purposes.
Okay, I already know, between this particular deputy and your new border guy shooting women, whatever, mom and San Diego guy, that these guys, they cannot allow something, especially if you're coming through their, you know, their hood, you know, all the time. You're in their house. They're kind of, you're going by, ooh, they can't let this go. They're not the type of people that let this go or they wouldn't be there.
Right.
So, I mean, there's, they want something. There's some kind of balance of something, because it just, I mean, they lose sleep over this and it freaking nuts them up. So, so what kind of response, has there been any retaliation so far on what you've accomplished before we get back to the case?
Yeah. No. You know, like I said, I think I've only been to the checkpoint a couple of times since this incident, because, like I said, I was out of town for quite a while there.
And wave through,
pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now this happened. You've been doing this over a decade. There always is the wave through, and then they get a new crop of guys, and then they get learnified again. You know, see, Shelton went through this when he got arrested for refusing to provide ID to an officer when he was covering something as a journalist for Freedom's Phoenix. And he goes, no, I don't have to. They arrest him. They put him in. He doesn't, because giving your fingerprints is a privilege, not an obligation or something like that, right? So he knew that I don't have to do it. I'm not cooperating. Well, finally, one of the jailers, he goes, oh, I can do it. You know, in the same attitude, I can do it. I'll get him. I can do it. They pull him out of his cell, and in his bare feet, he takes his jack boot, and he stomped and broke his toes to get him to do, to comply and distract, get a fingerprint. And I'm going, wow, this is the mentality that you're dealing with. I mean, FYI, man. So, this is not, you know, I say this because I don't want the people, I've had so many people that have gotten arrested, or they tell a story, I was inspired by someone that was on the show, or things that I've done, and I go, well, what the hell did you think was going to happen? You know, I mean, you don't be stupid, okay? So if you're going to do this, and there are other people who are doing it around the country, and other people are just asserting to say, am I being detained? You know, I mean, they'll do this, and they'll get away with it, or they'll take it to the next level, or they'll whatever. But I'm telling you, this is not something to take lightly. These are not the cream of the crop of the best of anything. These are the guys that get stuck, you know, they're sitting in their car getting time and a half because they're willing to do what they're doing, you know?
Right. I fully understand and fully recognize exactly what you're saying, and I fully agree with it. And what I try to tell people, you know, when I get into conversations like this, is look, you have to be ready to take this to the next level, okay? Because a good chance is it's not going to stop with, am I being detained? Because there's going to be some jackboot out there that says, oh, yeah, you're being detained all right, and this is how I'm going to detain you. And so you have to be ready to fight this in court. You have to be. You have to have the resources, the financial resources, the you know, friends and family that are going to back you up. You should have a social network set up with folks that are cognizant of the issues and are willing to support you publicly, you've got to be ready to follow this through, because it will not stop with MI being detained in the vast majority of cases. And if you're not prepared for that mentally and physically, you're going to be very confused when you are detained and bad things happen to you.
Yeah, you don't know what to do. See, in my situation, I'm a middle-aged white boy with some gray and a pudge, and it's kind of like, just let them go. But they always want to ask the question, so what do? I have my camera up, and I just have it. They see the camera, and they just wave me through about 70% of the time. The other time, they'll say, are you a U.S. citizen? And I years ago, I tried this, with the inspiration from you, but I go, that seems like a legal question. I go, I was born in a hospital in Florida. They go, what? I go, right, you ask me, I don't know. I mean, I was born in a hospital in Florida. And they go, never mind. And I go, because they go, are you a U.S. citizen? I don't know. I never saw the paper. I don't know.
Right.
So I keep asking them, and they just like, never mind, because they don't know. They're like, damn, I never thought of that, So I'm just going, you want to play lawyer? I'm not a lawyer. I don't know what the hell. Where's your evidence? Where's my evidence? How I could be lying? I don't know. So that has gotten me out of it. But, and it is a good point. I would be willing to go down. I said, he asked me. I told him where I don't know. Let's go to court on it. I think that would be interesting. I'm not confrontational. I'm not doing an am I being detained thing. I'm going, I don't know. I was born in a hospital. There's different ways of handling this. And I think that's probably, it's been effective for me so far. But, what do you think of that? I go, I don't know. I was born in the hospital. I don't know. And they're like, never mind. So anyway, it's worked so far. Okay, so you go in, the officer's up there, he's a fibber, and you show all the, did you get the question any of the border agents? Did you subpoena them?
Well, so the deputy, testified for about 5 minutes, and then I cross-examined him for about 20 minutes or so. And I dug into him pretty deep, and I found all sorts of interesting information. I determined that he had been deployed under this Operation Stone Garden grant program about 13 times since the beginning of the year. I asked him what his overtime pay rate was, and he told me it was about $45. I don't know if that's low or not, but assuming so that would mean that he's making about $30 an hour on average, which is what, somewhere around $50,000-$60,000 annually. So that means he's making, if you annualize his overtime through this Operation Stone Garden stuff, he's making about $10,000 in overtime pay every year under this program. And so that was pretty interesting to find out in and of itself. And that's a substantial chunk of change for someone. So
yeah, for 13 times of 13 days of showing up, that's sweet. I want $10,000 for 13 days of almost working.
Yeah. So these are 8-hour shifts that they do, and he's done it 13 times, so far this year, and it's only about halfway through the year, so he's probably going to do it about 26 times over the course of this fiscal year. And so these guys are making a lot of money from this, and therefore that's going to skew their reactions with regards to when the Border Patrol says, hey, harass this guy, they have an incentive to harass him.
I'm wondering about the supervisor that knew you, that even called him in to begin with. I mean, it cascaded into the Taggart, whatever his name is, the guy that initially did the stop stick thing. I mean, it started from there. That boy got his weenie whacked. Somebody took him in the back room and explained it to him. This all started with that, and the supervisor's kind of, and then it escalated, it goes up. I'm sure he had to report to somebody, and they go, didn't we have this conversation? You are not training. I mean, there's something had to happen. That would be an interesting freedom of information thing right there.
Right. I'll tell you, I know a lot of the ACLU has become fairly active now with regards to this issue, and I know ACLU doesn't, that's a four-letter word for a lot of folks there, but they do some good stuff on occasion, and they've been starting to run with the ball with regards to these checkpoint issues. And there's a local attorney here with the ACLU who's a litigant attorney who's starting to up the ante. And he's got 3 formal complaints against the Border Patrol right now and 1 lawsuit. One of the complaints is regards to roving patrol abuses, and there's some pretty awful roving patrol abuses that they've documented. within the Tucson sector. They've got another formal complaint with regards to checkpoint operations and abuses at checkpoints around the Tucson sector. And the third complaint is with regards to, I'm sure maybe you've heard about down in Aravaca, the local community down there has gotten completely pissed off at the Border Patrol with regards to the fact they can't leave their town. There's not a road that they can go down where they aren't stopped at a Border Patrol checkpoint.
Yeah, what is this, Palestine? I mean, this is really bad. You know, and I'm glad you're bringing this up. And I remember that town, didn't it used to have, like, it had the youngest mayor or something? It was some kid or something that became mayor there a decade ago or something. Is that the place? It's down by the border, right?
Yeah, they're like 14-15 miles north of the border, type of thing there. But they can't leave the community without being harassed by federal agents. School buses, the kids go to school, you know, the school buses get stopped at the checkpoints and the kids interrogated, and it's been going on and on. So about a year ago, they started a formal protest, and they brought a petition that was signed by about 60% of the residents. They're saying, hey, you know, what's going on with these checkpoints? Please provide us information that justifies their existence or get rid of them, you know. And the Border Patrol said, we got your petition, but we're not going to provide you any information. These checkpoints are necessary, you know, to protect y'all, and we're going to continue doing them, so suck it up type of thing. And so the residents said, well, screw that then. We're going to set up our own checkpoint monitoring system. So for months now, they've had residents from Aravaca that go out to the checkpoints, and they set up shop all day. And they videotape everything, and of course, you know, the agents have been harassing the monitors and that sort of thing, and threatening them with arrest and so forth and so on. So the ACLU has gotten involved with that, and now they've sent a formal complaint saying, if you don't stop interfering with the First Amendment rights of these monitors at these checkpoints, then we're going to bring suit. And the ACLU has actually brought suit with regards to FOIA requests. And this is stuff that I've been doing for 10 years, where I say, hey, I want copies of all your checkpoint guidelines, which dictate how these agents are supposed to be conducting operations at these checkpoints. And, of course, the Border Patrol has completely ignored me, and I've never, you know, gone to the next step and actually brought a lawsuit, but it's been something kind of a back burner for me. But the ACLU has actually done that. They got two law professors at the University of Arizona to file the initial FOIA request for copies of the checkpoint guidelines. Border Patrol, of course, refused to provide them, and now they've filed a lawsuit against the Border Patrol.
Okay, I want to insert something into this lawsuit. Yeah. When Pastor Anderson got his beat up and busted window and all that kind of stuff, and Mark Victor was the attorney and got him off, you know, the Yuma checkpoint thing, and they went to a civil suit, they got settled. I can't remember. I'm sure he came out ahead on that, and I need to follow up. I got an email from someone just a couple weeks ago asking me what happened with that, and I forgot what happened, you know, so many of these things. That Mark, during that time, he wanted the checkpoint freedom of information. All right, give me your checkpoint manual of the checkpoint of the book of the checkpoint. And no, it doesn't exist. Don't have one. No. And then I sent him a clip of Janet Napolitano up there talking about this manual. Okay. And I go, well, somebody's a lying sack of crap. Okay. Either Janet Napolitano, the head of the Gestapo, is lying, or they are. Something is going on here. And that became part of that case. And in fact, they did have something. So you might want to talk to Mark about that.
Well, I actually have a Border Patrol agent. You know, I actually get, you know, contacted by any number of different types of individuals, including Border Patrol agents that are pissed off at the way the Border Patrol...
Hey, I'm losing you on the mic. Get closer to the mic. I'm losing you there.
Oh, okay. I actually have it from a good source that there are two types of checkpoints manuals that the Border Patrol conducts or has. One is a national checkpoint set of guidelines, which applies to all sectors across the country. So it's kind of more of a generalized type of checkpoint guideline. But then each sector has its own set of guidelines, which are specific to the federal appeals court decisions within that particular sector. Okay, so there are actually two sets of guidelines for each sector for checkpoint operations.
So here's our operation checkpoint manual, and here's the revised version for the U.S. district that, you know, decided of a precedent of whatever the hell for that district.
And what's even more interesting, and I actually included this as one of my exhibits with my court appearance, was I have a copy of a page from a law bulletin that was issued to Border Patrol agents in the San Diego sector back in 2012. And for checkpoint encounters, this is the pertinent passage. It says, a subject's bad attitude or refusal to answer questions without more does not constitute reasonable suspicion and does not justify detention. Okay, let me read that again.
No, I understand, but big freaking deal.
Well, it's a big freaking deal because if I actually go to court over this stuff and I can show that they have a policy manual and that they've been issued a law bulletin that says, hey, guys, don't screw with people just because they have a bad attitude or they won't answer your questions. And then I can show my videos that shows that they're screwing with me because they don't like my attitude and because I don't want to answer their questions. That shows right there that I get attorney's fees when I win because it's well established that they had no legal right to engage in those activities.
No, I understand your point. Yeah. And they've got no legal. It's called the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the this amendment, the state constitution of that. I got all kinds of pieces of paper that say they're not supposed to do this. But that doesn't matter, okay? And I'm glad you're pointing this stuff out and you're able to do this and show, because this is I'm glad you're doing this because you do it right. But a lot of people, they'll go, well, constitution this and that. And I'm going, seriously, what did you think that this is? They don't care. I mean, they just don't care. And I want to make sure that people don't get into showing the piece of paper that you're talking about and see, it says that, bang. Don't ever think a piece of paper is going to save your ass. It's more the videotape than anything else. Okay.
Right, sure.
So I understand. I just don't want, I know, and they said, and I'm going, they don't care. Since when do they care? I mean, you're making them care. They're just coming up, well, that's not why we did it. It was because, his license plate had mud on it, or we couldn't read a letter, or, he had, low tread on his tire. I mean, it's all freaking something else. They'll just make it up. Something else.
Yeah, but that's the thing. You have to make them care, and finding the best way to make them care is the million-dollar question, right? And if nothing else, it's great fodder for showing the hypocrisy in the system. And to be frank, this is what got me involved with these types of things. Is I'm a guy. I hold a job. I believe in any number of things and blah blah blah. And I used to believe that ultimately government was a good thing. That they're there for our benefit. And yeah, there's some bad apples, but after you see case after case of situations where you have these agents that don't care and are clearly, violating well-established tenets of law and rules and regulations, that shows that, no, it's not just bad apples. It's the way the system is designed.
And let me tell you how the system is going to work. And your piece of paper that says, well, just because they don't answer is the next day changes into, when they don't cooperate, you get them. In fact, here in Arizona, I remember there was a big thing about, one, you don't have to show your ID unless you're suspected of committing a crime or going to commit a crime and standing there with a Molotov cocktail burning in your hand or something. Until right. then, you don't have to give your ID. Well, what do they want to do? They wanted to change the law that anytime an officer comes up, you must prostrate yourself, bend over, and do whatever the hell he tells you. Now, it didn't go through, but that doesn't stop them from trying or changing ink on paper. And so don't ever think that just because it says it, that it's always going to say that. And this is what you're doing, is to prevent them doing this without us noticing. Because that piece of paper, and we got a new piece of paper. The fact that you brought it up, now it's kind of locked in, because if they change it, and it's Nazi Germany, okay? Well, it already. But, the point is that you're doing this. I can understand. Okay, let's go ahead and finish the court thing. Did you have border agents on the stand?
No, I didn't actually subpoena any border patrol agents. I didn't get any of their name. Well, I didn't actually have adequate time to do everything that I wanted to do. So all I had, was the deputy there. And, so he testified for 5 minutes. I cross-examined for about 25 minutes. And then I presented my own testimony, which was a 14-page written statement, which I think I've uploaded and you've linked to on your page there, which I read verbatim, which pretty much outlines a lot of the history here, and the specific sequence of events that occurred with this particular encounter here.
And I also brought up some legal, you know, arguments with regards to, you know, your First Amendment issues with regards to protection of expressive speech with regards to honking the horn, and the fact that this specific statute that I was charged with violating, it makes an exception for honking a horn for safety purposes. So if there's a safety issue for other travelers, then you're actually obligated to honk your horn. And in this case, the Border Patrol agents created a safety hazard in the roadway by throwing a spike strip in the road and preventing the vehicular traffic. And what I brought to the court's attention was the fact that accidents at checkpoints occur all the time. And when agents illegally extend detentions like they did in my case, because they didn't like my attitude, which is a violation of the law bulletin, that they increase the danger to the traveling public. There's more of a chance that some guy, some driver who's not paying attention, doesn't realize that there's a checkpoint ahead and slams into the back of somebody else's vehicle and kills somebody. That when the agents act this way along a public highway, they're actually putting the public at risk. And I pulled up several news articles from across the country that showed fatal accidents at Border Patrol checkpoints in Texas and New Mexico. And I also pulled up from my civil rights lawsuit from 2002 when I was in Iraq. And so I have direct experience with this. I said, Judge, I have direct experience with the safety issues associated with these types of checkpoints. When I was, you know, stopped by the tribal police in the Border Patrol back in 2002, and I was just, you know, in the lane of traffic for a couple of minutes, there was an accident that occurred 10 cars behind me, you know, because, you know, some Joe Blow wasn't paying attention and ran into a car coming.
Now, is this border checkpoint that you, in this particular instance, is it still on the Tohono O'odham reservation or no?
No, the Border Patrol moved it just off, so it's just off the reservation. And I have it from good authority that the tribe is so pissed off at the Border Patrol and the type of harassment that tribal members get from the Border Patrol that they refuse to allow them to set it up within the tribal boundaries. So, you know, I'm sure they could have if they really wanted to, but I think they decided that, well, we'll just move it, you know, just off the reservation so that we don't have to get into
it. During the whole criminal process and serving and subpoenas and everything of the tribal police that was involved in the last, I mean, they already got a dose of Terry they didn't want to play anyway.
Right.
I mean, you know, so, all right. So you go through, you get to the trial, you do your closing arguments, and everybody rests, okay? So your closing argument you made, I don't know, whatever you wanted to say, and the judge, his participation in this was what? It was a guy, I imagine, was it?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So the judge, what's his name?
Hogan, Hearing Officer Hogan, H-O-L-G-U-I-N.
Okay, and, so Hogan, he goes like this. He's like, thank you. I take it under advisement, or he ruled then, or what happened?
He took it under advisement. He thanked me for the documentation that I provided, because I made copies for the court, too. So he's looking through my exhibits as I'm, you know, spieling with my written statement there.
Yeah, I'd be like, I dare you. I will overturn your ass on. This is going all the way.
But he actually thanked me. He said, Mr. Brescia, I noticed that you documented everything very well here, and you referred to your exhibits at the pertinent points within your statement here, so it's going to be very easy for me to cross-reference this when I sit down and review all this information later. I'm going to take it under advisement because there's too much information for me to digest right now, and I'll get back to you, you know, with a written order within a couple of weeks. And so I received a notice in the mail just earlier this week where he ruled in my favor and dismissed the charge against me.
Well, I saw that we showed the document up here. Let me see if I can just pull that up again so people can see it. The document is really simple. I mean, it's real short. It just says, and you're done. Okay. Let's see. Encounter transcript verdict. Okay. I go to the verdict, and it says, under advisement order, based on the testimony and evidence presented, the court finds the defendant not responsible of ARS 28-954B, excessive use of horn, done.
Right.
Done. Okay, so then is there a civil action based on this?
My next course of action here is to pursue this open records request with the Pima County Sheriff's Department. So I need to get more documentation in hand with regards to how they're conducting these Stone Garden deployments, and then decide how I want to go from here. You know, the problem is finding an attorney who isn't going to break the bank to bring a civil action forward.
Or do it myself, which is a possibility, but I'm already so time constrained that it makes me nervous trying to do anything too big on my own, because I could set bad precedent by doing something and not doing it right.
The first thing is, like, you know what you're doing. I mean, you just keep going through the process and, you know, make sure you really want to say no, because at some point, you know, this is this Stone Garden thing, that is something that we could just do as a funding center thing. I mean, there's plenty of database that you have and people and interested in on Freedom's Phoenix, the funding center of just re-raise money, because, I mean, yep. That's what it's for.
Right. And I would definitely like to go that road.
We raised enough money for fully informed jury billboards that are going up in here in Phoenix. We just had them go up in the last week. Na 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 na.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, I know. James Babb out of Philadelphia is heading that up, and I let me help, man, because he did a GoFundMe campaign, got him up in the metro in Washington D.C., and Department of Justice didn't like it none too much, and eventually GoFundMe was putting it in L.A. and Phoenix, and GoFundMe said, and we canceled it. You know, and we're not going to give it to you. Why? Well, because. Okay. So I'm going, yeah. And then the city of L.A. and Phoenix, we've been in negotiation back and forth. When I went to Port just this last month, when I got back, if the city of Phoenix had not approved to allow the bus station billboards to go up, the advertisements, if they didn't, because we just had Gun Save Lives, you know, Corwin and, Train Me AZ gun thing, you know, we just got ruling on that, you know, in favor of, you know, Bite Me. And I'm going, you know, they don't approve this artwork. You know, it's a commercial thing. We'd working with Fiji to buy your kid of I'm Informed. I go, they don't do that. Oh, it's on like Donkey Kong. It's on like Alderaan. So I'm going, yeah, let's go. Let's go kick some ass. And then they approved it. I'm like, damn it. I'm going, yeah. So this is, I mean, sometimes you just need a government number. You know what I mean? All right.
Right.
Is there anything else you want to give out? Give out your webpage, and then, of course, whatever else you want to say. And thanks for spending the extra time.
Oh, sure. www.checkpointusa.org/blog, or just do a search for Roadblock Revelations. And, I've got a lot of good information on the blog about this case and others, and other things that are happening in the area. I've been mentioning several national news articles recently. One that made it to the USA Today that started at the Arizona Republic from, I think, Bob Ortega was the journalist who actually did an interview with me earlier this year and wrote up a thing about checkpoints. And on Slate, the online Zine there, they just ran a big article on checkpoints where I was interviewed, and they got some more information about that. And I've also been, in my spare time, been conducting accountability through transparency video contest. And I've been working with CopBlock and Free Talk Live, where I've been sponsoring the prizes for first place winners. Last year, I think I did a handheld high definition camera, and this year I did a pair of pivot head wearable video sunglasses for the person who makes the best video with regards to videotaping an encounter with a government agent and showing how this can help bring accountability to the system.
On a 1 to 10, your wife is how concerned? I mean, how much do you share with her that she's kind of, you know, gives you a big, giant, passionate kiss every time you leave and get in your car? I mean, you know, what's her level of anxiety?
Every time I try to downplay, you know, a lot of this, but she gets it. And pretty much every time I bring to her attention something that I'm involved with, she expresses concern over my safety. So.
Thank you. I mean, seriously, this is, I mean, you understand your place in history as this gets kind of the manual of the documentary of the classroom of the lawyer thing, right?
I do what I can. You know, I think if everybody took, you know, one issue that was near and dear to their heart and ran with it, it'd be much easier for all of us. You know, there's safety in numbers. People who are concerned about what government is doing need to speak up, they need to stand up, and they need to take some action. It doesn't need to be, you know, what to the level that I'm doing it or anybody else, but do something, speak out, make your concerns known so that people like me and you can't be marginalized at the level that we currently are.
Terry, thank you very much. This is awesome time that we got everything. I know it's in, the archive, but I'm glad that we got to have the whole trial thing without commercial interruption. What a pain in the ass. But, it's out there. People can understand. They'll go to Freedom's Phoenix and get this. You just do Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, Bressy, B-R-E-S-S, I and Declare Your Independence, or Terry Bressy and Freedom's Phoenix, or Terry Bressy and Ernest Hancock, and this show will come up, and you can watch the video. You get plenty out of the audio too. It's checkpointusa.org, and follow this. I mean, Terry is doing this, a lot of it behind the scenes out there on the Lone Prairie in the middle of the freaking desert. A 911 call ain't going to get an F-16 there, any faster than 30 minutes. So, I mean, he's out there by himself, all alone from the beginning, just a little over a year after 9/11 this started. I remember it was December of 02, and I started radio in February of 03, and we started covering this. And one of the things that you did, I want to point this out, I was trying to get it to come up, the guard tower thing, that they had these mobile guard towers, they have a trailer behind their Suburban, and all of a sudden you get on both sides of the road and boom, this little pillbox kind of elevated, bulletproof, whatever the hell thing, instant roadblocks, and you're not going to have these kind of permanent roadblock kind of crap anymore. They're going to have to actually start making them mobile. They've been testing this forever, and I'm telling you, the police state would have already been here much worse than it is right now if it wasn't for Terry Bressy. I really do sincerely believe that, and I'm just glad that you're there, Terry. Thank you, Mr. Titanium Testicle Terry.
Well, thank you, Ernie. It's great to have you on the side of liberty.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, man. Hey, brother, I don't even want to tell you to say anything to your wife. It'll just make her more anxious. Just be quiet. All right, man. Peace, brother. Thanks for coming on. Any more news about your freedom of information, all that kind of stuff, make sure we know. Would you please?
I certainly will.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, buddy. Bye.
Bye.